Thank you, Nick. Nice to see you, John. You are listening to LBC. The time is approaching 10 o'clock. And I'm going to take you back to the jury stuff, because if someone had said to me when I was at school they're going to abolish trial by jury, I'd have been signing up for the Sixth Form Debating Society in a state of high dudgeon. And yet, it appears that the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, is going to, well, sort of smooth it through the statute book without a great deal of objection or anger. So I'd quite like to hear some objections and some anger. I'm haunted. Haunted, I tell you, by a caller earlier in this conversation, last week, I think, who was opining about how stupid people are, which is a fairly good grounds not to have a jury service, but then she almost fell foul of the rules regarding the jury room. So are we stupider than ever?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the Justice Secretary has told LBC that jury trials will remain a cornerstone of the court system. David Lammy is expected to announce plans to limit juries to more serious criminal cases in England and Wales. It's hoped the plan will reduce a backlog of more than 80,000 Crown Court cases. But former Old Bailey judge Wendy Joseph is sceptical about the potential changes.
Judges may be very good at the law and they may be quite clever people. That doesn't make them any better at finding facts and assessing where the truth lies than anybody else. So if you take away the jury system, you've got one mind working on the problem. If you have the jury system, you've got 12 people.
12 more prisoners have been mistakenly freed in the past month, and two are still at large. That's on top of the 91 accidental releases in England and Wales between April and the end of October. David Lammy says the two inmates still missing are not violent or sexual offenders, but refused to give further details. The inquiry into the murder of Sarah Everard is set to publish further findings about women's safety. The Angelini inquiry was set up after the 33-year-old was killed by the off-duty police officer Wayne Cousins in March 2021. It is due to report on measures to stop sexually motivated crimes in public places. Donald Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff is due to meet Vladimir Putin in Moscow later to discuss the US-backed plan to end the war in Ukraine. The White House says it's very optimistic about reaching an agreement. Ukraine's leader Volodymyr Zelensky says there have been improvements, but territory remains the most difficult element of the plan.
On the topic of security guarantees, we have concrete details from the US, concrete details from Europe. I'd say that these are the three main topics, tracks, but also triggers. We need to be very careful here. I thank our negotiation teams. The plan looks better.
New forecasts suggest UK inflation is set to remain among the highest in the G7. The OECD says it will top the list of advanced economies this year and remain the second highest at 2.5% next year. It's warned growth will slow from 1.4% to 1.2% in 2026. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading up 11 points at 97.14. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.30. LBC weather, feeling colder with sunny spells for many, scattered showers developing in the south and west, a high of 11 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Minutes after 10 is the time. A very good morning indeed to you. I hope that you are well. There is quite a lot to get through today. You won't be surprised to learn I haven't reached any final decisions about exactly what it is we are going to do. We're definitely going to start with jury service, or at least the imminent abolition of many, many jury trials. That is likely to unfold on our watch. We're expecting David Lammy's speech, in which the finer detail will emerge at about 12:30 today. I'm drawn also to the Attorney General calling upon Nigel Farage to apologise two contemporaries who have been queuing up to claim that he racially abused them at school, including some of the worst anti-Semitism imaginable, citing gas chambers and Holocaust and much else. And it just occurred to me that if you were a Jeremy Corbyn fan, if you were still a Jeremy Corbyn fan, albeit that most, if not all, of the accusations levelled at his apparent comfort with anti-Semitism in the ranks of the Labour Party he led were justified and accurate, which I appreciate. If you're still a Jeremy Corbyn fan, you still struggle to accept that, despite all the evidence. How on earth would you account for the fact that Nigel Farage's absolutely rancid anti-Semitism, as recalled by a growing number of his contemporaries at Dulwich College, appears to be going almost unremarked by precisely the same media ecosystem that goes after people accused of much milder offences in a similar sphere, like a rat up a drainpipe? I mean, hand on heart, I'm conscious both of the sensitivities of the issue and of my own confusion at the way in which Farage appears to be getting a free pass even on telling Jewish schoolmates that Hitler was right and simulating the sound of gas showers while bullying them. That is the recollection of at least one former school friend. And I've seen some claims that it shouldn't matter or that no one can remember accurately. I'm telling you now, if you were the victim of racist bullying when you were at school, I don't care if you're 80 or 18, you can still remember it now. You can remember every syllable of it. You can probably remember the little flecks of spittle emerging from the mouth of the boy that was shouting at you and landing on your shoulder or your uniform. So I think we can park that immediately and possibly move on a little later to the question of why Farage once again appears to be getting a free pass on behaviour that, had it been anybody else accused of this, would be an offence egregious enough to see from space. So we took a call, I think last week, from, or possibly yesterday, as I am absolutely fascinated by big stories that I can't muster up an informed and strong opinion on. And it has to be informed. I think when Clive Bull joined us yesterday to pay tribute to the late, great Brian Hayes, he reminded us, really, of the importance of an informed opinion. A strong opinion is not necessarily an informed opinion. In fact, quite the opposite is often true. You have some of the more infamous callers to this program appearing with very, very strong opinions, which, when you pay them the courtesy of presuming that they are built upon evidence and information, they concede that they're not built on evidence or information at all. You can't expect me to know any facts, or you can prove anything with facts, O'Brien. Used to be regular refrains on the show. So the difference between a strong and informed opinion and a merely strong opinion is remarkable, isn't it? And important to track. But I have neither. I don't think I could be much better informed. I don't think there is a sort of trove of information that has been unaccessed by us. I am, for example, well aware of interventions in this space made previously by members of the government, up to and including Keir Starmer, not to mention David Lammy, both lawyers by training and both adamant in the past that jury service was a sort of a sacred cow, an unslayable principle that nobody should ever dare to meddle with. And both of them now, Lammy in particular, apparently comfortable with the idea of jury trials being denied to a rather large cohort of the accused. I tell you how boring I am. I tried to read Magna Carta on a couple of occasions, and I am aware of two things. Trial by jury was a democratic principle enshrined in that document, but also it wouldn't have applied to the likes of you and me. Don't kid yourself. Magna Carta was chiefly about limiting the power of the monarch over the barons. It had very little to do with Joe Schmo or the man on the Clapham ox cart. Quite the opposite, in fact. But again, it is something that has always been there. It would have, I think, felt a little like that old analogy about getting the eggs out of a baked cake. I might have applied to jury trials once. If you were thinking about the legal system and somebody said, we're going to take away trial by jury, you'd have said, that's like trying to get the eggs out of a baked cake. And yet, of course, it isn't. It's a relatively straightforward process under which thousands of cases will become judge-only trials. Burglary, fraud, drug dealing, and similar, are now set to become judge-only trials. Nearly 80,000 cases currently caught up in the backlog. Justice delayed is famously justice denied, and David Lammy is expected to announce today that the right to trial by jury will go in either way cases, i.e. cases where defendants are given the choice to have their cases heard in a magistrate's court or a crown court. I suppose one way into this is to wonder why you would opt for a crown court, if not because you believe you have a better chance of a favourable verdict, or you want to prolong the agony of your victim in ways that you couldn't do if you went to magistrate's court. There were about 13,000 of these cases last year that actually went before juries, so you'd be taking away that right from between 10 and 20,000 accused, and instead the case would be heard by a single judge. Brian Leveson's recommendation, and he was charged by the government with looking into ways to reduce this backlog, was that they should be heard by a judge and two magistrates. But they've done away with that. And he's rowed back slightly from some of the other cases that would have been filed under this. They would have taken away an automatic right to trial by jury under some of the early plans that were seen, but as it stands, unless there is a big surprise, a big rabbit pulled out of a big hat come 12:30 today, it will be either way cases where you can currently opt either for a magistrate's court or a jury, a crown court trial, and you will have that right taken away. So, 11 minutes after 10 is the time. I'm conscious also of this being a question I've asked you a couple of times already, and other presenters as well have been nibbling at the same nuggets, but I still want to hear more from you. I really do. I found it slightly inspiring yesterday, albeit that it was a very sad moment, but to be reminded of what Brian did to this genre of radio, to be reminded of the importance of actually engaging with what people say, asking them to explain themselves. So lawyers, we haven't heard enough from lawyers yet on this question. Would I be betraying a confidence if I told you about a little chat that John Cleese and I just had in the, is it called the airlock, Keith? That room outside? Do we call it the airlock? I mean, to be honest, my day's already peaked. I don't know what you're going to have to bring to the table in order to top the fact that I just made John Cleese laugh. That's up there. That's kind of things that I miss my dad when things like that happen, because I'd have rung him straight after the show and say, Dad, I just made John Cleese laugh at a joke. But we were discussing the fact that lawyers are not necessarily the most reliable people to whom we should turn at a time when their own livelihood is being somewhat curtailed. So I trial before a single judge is going to offer up, I would have thought, a lot fewer billable hours for barristers, if not solicitors, than a trial before a jury. I could be wrong about that, 0345 60 60 973. But I don't think that there is necessarily a lot of room for dispute on the observation that if your meter is running, the comparison you might draw would be with black cab drivers, to whom I bow to nobody in my admiration of, but if the meter is running, and I'm very glad that the black cab drivers of London always resist this temptation, but if the meter is running, the temptation to take a little bit longer to get to your destination than you would if you were being paid a flat fee must sometimes be close to irresistible. So we'll get lawyers up as well, 0345 60 60 973. Do we worry about racism? I mean, I think that dreadful woman who hates seeing brown people in adverts was a magistrate for a while, although she got into a little bit of bother during that period of her so-called career. If you were to find yourself in front of somebody like that as a person of colour, you could rightfully fear for fairness. Would that extend into the judiciary from the realms of magistrates, who are, of course, by definition, civilians, into the realms of professional jurists and judges? I don't know. You tell me. I'm white. As a black man, would you worry about not getting the chance to go in front of a jury? Because even if you've got a racist juror or three, you've got nine who would be pushing back against their obvious prejudice and bigotry. Then we have the jurors themselves. I don't know how important this is. I kind of oscillate, depending on the question, between valuing lived experience over mere opinion. And then sometimes, of course, expertise is mere opinion, and it trumps lived experience. People, if you need proof of why lived experience isn't the gold standard of conversation, you will often encounter people who don't believe that colds exist because they've never had a cold. I'm reaching a little with that, but you understand what I mean. Something has never happened to them, therefore it can't be real. Similarly, lived experience of knowing someone who knows 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 someone who's ripping off the benefit system is not necessarily proof that everybody is. Although, of course, you could get a column in most national newspapers making precisely that point in slightly more flowery language. So lived experience is not the trump card in all conversations, but it is in many. And I wonder whether your experience as a juror leaves you worried about the abolition of many, many juries, or actually rather warm towards the idea. I wonder how long I can get through without mentioning the person that I have all year mentioned whenever we turn our attention to juries. And technically, I haven't mentioned them yet. I've alluded to them. That's not the same thing at all. Maybe need a trial by jury to decide whether or not I'm telling the truth. So lawyers, jurors, punters, potential defendants can all bring personal perspectives, lived experience style perspectives to the table. 0345 6060 973. What about the rest of us? What about the rest of us? Well, we're still in the weeds of the philosophy of it, the kind of democratic principles, the idea that being judged by a jury, being scrutinized by a jury of our peers, is something valuable that is in need of passionate protection. And I am not feeling that still in the way that I expected to. I'm really not. It could be because I had such a strange experience. The one thing I did take away from my experience of jury service, even though I never got on a jury despite sitting for 2 weeks in Isleworth, was that the people running it, the clerks of the court or the sort of civil servants, two ladies in particular at Isleworth, were among the most consummate professionals I've ever had the pleasure of seeing in action. The way they juggled the stresses of the role, the extraordinary logistics, the timings, some people turning up late, some people disappearing, having to get 12 juries together several times a day, often at the drop of a hat, discharging them. The logistical nightmare that they navigated was an absolute inspiration to behold. And it took away a lot of my confusion about why the system can seem so sclerotic and so slow. I'll tell you why much of the judicial system is so sclerotic and so slow, shall I? Would you like to know why? You might want to write this down. Because it's full of people. It's full of people, and the more full of people something is, the harder it is to get organised. Like nailing jelly to a wall or herding cats. There must have been hundreds of people in the building where I did my jury service, and there were essentially two women and their colleagues charged with keeping us all in order, making sure we were all in the bits that we were supposed to be in, that they had 12 jurors ready to sit in judgment on a case, and that there was no room for quibbling, complaining or miscarriages of justice. And some of those juries were going to be there for weeks, and they even handled that fairly very professionally. Schemes and systems in place to minimise the slowness and the danger. You'd be surprised how many people have allowed their experience of watching The Traitors influence their opinions regarding jury service. An awful lot of people who might once have been passionate defenders of jury service watched the last series of The Traitors and have come away convinced that it's an absolutely daft thing to do to entrust the fate of people into the hands of their peers, of 12 good men and women and true. So, all the way, please, 0345 6060 973. Thousands of cases to be judge-only trials. What is your personally informed perspective on that? Your experiences as a judge, perhaps, although I don't think we'll get many calls from them. A juror? We've had former judges on, haven't we, I think, on other subjects. I can't remember whether. I think we've had one on this subject as well, certainly former magistrates. So a judge, a jurist, a lawyer, of course, and a defendant or a potential defendant, which of course encompasses pretty much all of us. And then on the more philosophical side of things, the question of what exactly is it that we're supposed to be so fearful of losing? 90 minutes after 10 is the time. The number you need is 0345 6060973.
LBC.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddy.
New In, the latest custom-fit rechargeable hearing devices. Discreet, comfortable and smart enough to help you catch every moment. Book a free hearing test at bootshearingcare.com. T's and C's apply.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. All wobbly, all wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thames Link Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
At Laithwaite's, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high, and low. And we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track, we certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at laithwaites.co.uk. Laithwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
It is 21 minutes after 10. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where we are poised to hear news of the abolition of thousands of jury trials, thousands of cases to be rendered judge-only, which are currently so-called either-way cases, where the accused can choose to go to Crown Court, should they so desire, or to stay in front of magistrates. About 13,000 defendants availed themselves of that opportunity last year alone, and they will no longer be able to. What do you think about that? We'll start with Yasmin, who's in Canning Town. Yasmin, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Hello. Hello. I'm a criminal defence barrister, and I'm also a black woman. But I want to put any issues to do with race aside, because this is such a hugely important issue for absolutely everybody, regardless of their racial background, class, etc. It doesn't matter. It affects us all. In the list of people you mentioned to this effect, you said punters. I want to underline that we are all punters, okay?
Well, I did. In my defence, I thought I had underlined that. I said that means all of us.
Well, yeah, no, you did. No, it's not a criticism on you. In fact, I'm underlining the point. Because, you know, until you are up against a charge, or if you want to live in a safer society where hopefully we are putting the right people into prisons, it affects us all. First of all, I want to assure you and everybody listening that financial considerations, the whole point of clocking up the hours to get more money, that ship has sailed. One does not go to the criminal bar to make money at all.
No, yeah, I mean, I have read the books of The Secret Barrister and spoken to friends who are barristers, and I appreciate that is a slightly outmoded, certainly at many levels of the profession, that is a slightly outmoded process. Not at all, but I hear you. If somebody says you would be like turkeys voting for Christmas if you wanted to abolish jury trials, you wouldn't be talking complete gibberish, but I'm happy to rein in some of the hyperbole that I deployed mere moments ago, my love. M'lady.
Also, I think David Lammy mentioned that he's dangling some sort of financial incentive for barristers, saying that pay will be risen. Well, that might mean that it might go along with the rate of inflation, but everybody's in the same boat with this question. But I also want to emphasise that when it comes to jury trials, a holistic approach to justice is so important. If we abolish jury trials, that will be lost.
Hang on a minute. Most people won't know, and I'm not splitting hairs here. You can't just say a holistic approach is really important, and if we abolish them, that will be lost. When most people listening, or certainly me, and I'm listening, don't really know what you mean by that.
Yeah. Well, what it means is that when it comes to judging human behaviour and making decisions about that, if you have a jury that's made up of people from different walks of life, different life experiences, etc., you're more likely, in my opinion, in my submission, to get a higher quality of justice than you are if you're up against a case-hardened tribunal that has more limited, limited range of life experience. That's just pure fact. It's really
not pure fact. It's absolutely opinion. And you can't say it's pure fact and then say it's really nuanced.
Well, I guess I can.
Approach the bench. Approach the bench. That's outrageous. You can't literally go in the space of a sentence from claiming that it's a fact to saying that it's nuanced. And I think in the sentence before that, you said, that's just my opinion. So,
I
don't like this because it flies in the face of everything I believe and everything that gets me out of bed to come to work in the morning.
Yes.
But people are increasingly stupid.
Well, they really are.
They increasingly, I mean, just let's start with Brexit. People can be persuaded to believe absolutely anything in the right circumstances. And you would hope at least that a judge, this is why Paul Dacre hated the judges so much, because they were actually handing down correct and informed and intelligent judgments. It's just that that obviously highlighted the idiocy of Brexit. So the then editor of the Daily Mail hated it. I don't know that I agree that I should put my faith or my fate in the hands of my fellow citizens, because they are susceptible. What, I mean, okay, what is it, 1025? What about the woman I met on jury service who thinks Michelle Obama is a man?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, but that's part of it. That's what I'm saying about holistic approach.
But I'm here to tell you, I'm here to tell you there are no judges who, I mean, even if they believed Michelle Obama was a man, they wouldn't be stupid enough to say it in chambers.
Well, I mean, to what extent is that going to affect a person's ability to judge?
Well, you tell me. You're the one that wants her in the jury.
Well, I think the main point is a really pertinent question you asked.
Yes.
You said, what is it that we should be fearful of losing? What are we fearful of? It's the right to a fair trial. But we don't know what that feels like.
I know.
And unfortunately, if this does come in, we will become very acquainted with what that feels like very quickly.
I think I'd rather have a judge than a newspaper editor sitting in control of discourse or decision making. But I don't feel what you're trying to articulate. And I hand on heart, Yasmin, I expected to. I really did. But you're not telling me. You're saying you're going to lose holistic justice or you're going to lose the right to a fair trial. But you're not giving me the evidence, ironically enough, to support those statements, to support those ideas. Why am I not going to get, what if I get 12 Daily Telegraph readers on my jury? I'm doomed.
But you're more likely to not.
Or vaccine deniers. Vaccine deniers. Or racists. Or, I mean, you know, a judge. I'm very, very close to saying it, a bit like democracy, it's the least bad option. It's not the actual jury, but the judge, the least bad option, the process which is least likely to be susceptible to all of the problems I'm thinking of and mentioning to you, is somebody who's risen through the ranks of your profession, which would be very hard to do without the approval of colleagues and contemporaries, to a point where they get to sit in judgment, where they get to actually be on the bench.
Well, one thing I would say is that our justice system is something that as a country we should be so proud of and is one of our greatest exports. And if we get rid of this aspect of it, that is going to erode it and we will live to regret it.
I hear you, but again, that's abstract and forgive me, but borderline nebulous. It is just something else that we should value because we should value it. Why is it so valuable? Why is it one of our most precious exports? Because it was once... something of value. And I think the further back in history you went in pursuit of this, you would have the argument that, in fact, juries were good because they undermined the ability of a landowner to influence the bench, or the judge would be the brother of the local aristocrat, or, you know, they would be in the pocket of vested interests. And I'm rather proud of the fact that, for all its myriad flaws in this country, the judiciary is almost never, I can't think of any real examples, exposed to allegations, let alone proven allegations, of abject corruption. A little bit of stupidity sometimes. When I started in this job, you'd still get hideous dinosaurs claiming that victims of sexual assault should have dressed differently and things like that, but I don't remember seeing anything like that recently. I just wonder if it's anachronistic to think that it's the best way of doing things and that the world has turned. It's turned away from the days of patronage, corruption and cronyism, and it's turned towards a population that is increasingly enthralled to absolute nonsense. I only mentioned Brexit slightly tongue-in-cheek, not entirely. You can persuade 52% of an electorate to hit themselves over the head with a frying pan, then a good lawyer can persuade them that up is down, that black is white. Nigel Farage is currently leading in the opinion polls. What does that say about the ability to select a jury that has the ability to analyse evidence and arrive at fact-based conclusions in this country at this point? Not a lot. Not a lot, but I take your point, Yasmin, and I'm not crossing the line. I don't know whether I ever will, but I want to think I'm capable of doing so. Like any good jurist, I like to think that if the facts change, I'll change my mind. So, give me the facts that you think might change my mind. 0345 6060973. Thomas Watts is here with your headlines.
12 more prisoners have been mistakenly freed in the past month, and two are still at large. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, says he has reassured the missing inmates are not violent or sexual offenders. Jury trials are expected to be scaled back as part of efforts to cut the court backlog in England and Wales. Mr. Lammy is expected to restrict their use to more serious offences. Donald Trump's special envoy is due to meet Vladimir Putin for talks on the war in Ukraine. The White House says it's very optimistic about Steve Witkoff's meeting in Moscow. LBC weather feeling colder today with sunny spells for many, some showers in the south and west, a high of 11 degrees.
This is LBC.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
A southern train is a place where family moments become more peaceful. Where you can spread out and a game of I Spy gets a scenic upgrade with snacks, stories and the occasional sheep for a bonus point. Less stress, more yes with kids tickets for £2 at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad!
Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use,
interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down, not off, said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with 3 tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
There's an old Thai saying that roughly translates as, the family who takes the internet on holiday can locate a less crowded beach. Particularly handy, my friend, if it's peak mating season for nippy little crabs. Pack the internet with an eSIM from Airalo. That's A-I-R-A-L-O.
At Fidelity, we've been helping our customers plan for their retirements for nearly 20 years. From understanding how much you'll need to combining multiple pensions, we offer expert insights, excellent service, and even financial advice, so you can feel confidently invested in your future. For pensions, advice, or investment accounts, be invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Transferring is not right for everyone. Terms apply.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 10:32, and it is, I mean, for my money, one of the most interesting conversations we've had in ages, because I can't see certainty. I just can't. You can, but I can't. Why is it such an appalling idea in the minds of so many to get rid of juries in thousands of cases? Or at least to get rid of the choice to have a jury, the option to have a jury. What am I, yesterday's show, what are we supposed to be angry about? Wasn't it interesting? Nobody could tell us. I read some of the columnists today who are furious about Rachel Reeves and adamant that she needs to go. I read all of one of them. It was the biggest pile of bilge I've seen in an extremely long time, since the last time I read a Richard Littlejohn column, actually. But still not clear on what, they don't even know what they're angry about. But they're all very funny. At least we can agree about that. I might read you a bit later just to show you how hilarious they are. So yesterday, what are we actually supposed to be angry about? And today it's not a million miles away from that with the issue of juries. Why is getting rid of them going to be such an appalling thing? Some of the messages you send in get me. And they make me go, whoa. So Elliot writes, I love you, James, but he's not weird. That's just the best way to get a critique read out on the programme, to begin it by softening me up in that pathetic fashion. As in, I'm pathetic, not him. I love you, James, but you're terrifying me now. I fear for when the fascists get into power, as in America, and juries of our peers will be our last line of defence. That's from Elliot in Braemar. And again, perhaps naively, I don't know that I agree. I think the juries are more easy to nobble than the judges. That possibly does make me sound very naive, but I'm thinking again about the attacks upon our judiciary by the people that Elliot chooses to describe as the fascists, whether it's Daily Mail executives putting together front pages that say enemies of the people regarding High Court judges, or whether it is honest Bob Jenrick revealing that he's making lists of immigration judges, many of whom now are reporting threats to their safety and threats to their life. We may be hearing a little bit more about that later in the programme. That they're the people I'm worried about, and juries seem to me to be much more susceptible to the ministrations of the fascists than they are, than judges would be. But again, obviously, that is one of the first things you'd change if you got into power, as Donald Trump has demonstrated, if you could. Neil's in Alton. Neil, what would you like to say?
Good morning, James.
Hello, Neil.
Okay, so I've got a couple of thoughts about this, James. One's based on experience and one's just an opinion.
Go on.
So the experiential thing was, I sat in jury service a few years ago now. It's a fairly serious case. Obviously, I won't go into any details.
No,
but in the jury deliberations, what struck me was there was a couple of people there you could tell just didn't want to be there and just wanted to finish as early as possible. There was one conspiracy theorist who just didn't believe anything that the police said, but the police had got it in for everyone. There was two or three people that just kind of went with the breeze, whatever arguments put forward they would lean with.
Yeah.
We'd left it to quite a small number in the room to actually pick through the evidence and go through it in a systematic way and come to a considered opinion, a considered verdict.
Did those people, in your view, prevail?
Yes.
Then the pendulum swings back, doesn't it? The pendulum swings back.
Correct. So we did come to the right verdict, and the judge kind of, in his opinion, agreed.
Yeah.
So I think the system worked, but it didn't leave me filled with faith about it 100%. So that's my first kind of thing. My second thing, my opinion is that I think for less serious cases, I would be very happy to let the judiciary, the professionals in the judiciary, deal with that, because they're doing it day in, day out. They're listening to prosecution, defence, evidence. It's what they do. They've got a very well attuned, nose for this kind of thing. And I think in less serious offences, they're more than capable, whether it's a judge or a tribunal of judges, to come up with a fair verdict, and I would trust them to do that.
I do too. And I mean, here's another statistic that might be interesting. About a third of people who ask for a trial by jury then plead guilty at the last possible minute. So loads of time and resources have been expended. The victim has been denied justice, or at least, at the very least, had their justice delayed. It would speak to the possibility that everybody knows they're bang to rights, up to and including the accused, but the system allows them to postpone judgment while they, either crack on with their criminal activities if they're not on probation or remand, I beg your pardon, if they're not on remand, or just, do it for reasons of mischief. A third. It's quite a high figure.
System. Yeah, correct. So I think, but I think for the more serious cases, rape, murder, serious financial fraud, I think that this is where a jury does have a place, because because I think it's more safe, but I think for the reassurance of the defendants that they are being tried by jury for a very serious offence that carries a much higher tariff sentence for them, that at least they can say, well, I've had my jury to decide.
The problem I've got, of course, is that if you are in favour of it for low-level cases, then theoretically, and sort of according to all academic or philosophical precepts, you should also be in favour of it for serious cases as well, and yet I'm not. So there's a bit of cognitive dissonance there.
I think that's based on risk, though, James, risk to the defendant. I think because the less serious cases carry a less harsh tariff sentence. So the risk of a huge miscarriage of justice, I think, is lower. And I think that they tend to be easier to listen to the evidence on those kind of cases.
The more serious
ones are more complex than they have. More complex evidence and things
yeah,
like
no, I hear you. I mean, to be fair, on a really complicated fraud case, I'd probably swim the other way and almost want professional jurists, individuals with expert knowledge of that particular section of the law. I'm not inventing that. It is a thing. Off the top of my head, I couldn't give you examples of where it is deployed. But miscarriages of justice cut both ways. We think immediately of the innocent people who've been sent wrongly to jail, always, of course, in jury trials, but because they couldn't have been tried in any other way. But guilty people getting off as well is more likely to happen. Just looking at conviction rates, guilty people getting off is more likely to happen with a jury than it is with a judge. I think, you know, we've all taken calls in the last month or so from people who have had experience of somebody saying, oh, I know they're guilty, but I don't want them to have this on their record, or it'd be terrible if they weren't at home for Christmas, or they've got little children and I don't want to be the one that takes them away. I don't have a problem with those impulses. I think they're human and humane impulses, humanitarian impulses, all the H's. But I don't know that I want them in the jury room or in the jury deliberations. Not if they prevail, which is why Neil's point about the sensibles prevailing was so powerful. Also, of course, the judge provides guidance. And you know, if the judge is providing guidance, then they have arrived at a conclusion. And whose conclusion would you trust more? The judges or the jury, which breaks down according to the parameters that Neil described. Some people who don't want to be there, some people who don't believe that the world is round. Some people who think Michelle Obama is a man. Some people who really just go in whichever way the wind is blowing. More people in that category than any of us like to admit, to be honest with you. The conspiracy, the whole shebang. Thank you, mate. Andrew's in Havering. Andrew, what would you like to say?
Well, I've just come back off a jury service.
Oh, yes.
And literally within a week.
Okay.
And I was quite sceptical about doing it beforehand. Didn't really see too much of a point.
Okay.
But then got lucky to got called for a trial, and it changed my view, particularly the jury room afterwards.
Yes, which is the bit you're really not allowed to talk to me about,
no.
Or at least not in any meaningful detail. But so give me in broad brushstrokes. Why has it changed your view? Presumably, you've gone from being sceptical to being very supportive of the right to a trial by jury.
100%. I mean, this broke when we were on a break. It was announced on the news during the week, and all 12 of us were sitting around, and we were like, oh my God. And when we got into the jury room, it sort of dawned on all of us, and we had the full gamut of people there, all your conspiracy theorists, those who didn't want to be there, the absolute whole lot.
Yeah.
And over the course of the trial, it dawns on you how much you can change someone's life.
Yeah.
Both for the good, both for the good and the bad. So we sat there, and I suppose my real point is that if you've got one person, i.e. the judge, that gets the pre-trial pack, reads it, it's human nature to have a view straight away. And I was like that.
Okay.
Right to begin the trial, read the bits and pieces we were given, all the agreed points, and then got to the jury room, and 12 different opinions.
Gosh.
And 12 different things that we all picked up on. And, there was some were going to say guilty, some were going to say not guilty.
Yeah.
Some were undecided. And by the end of it, I know we got to the right verdict, but if you've already made up your mind, like I'd made up my mind on the case itself.
But why is that? Why is what you're describing an argument against just letting a judge do it?
Because if you've only got one person, if I'd been that judge,
yeah,
my view would have been made up, and I'd listen to the the judge obviously gets all the evidence. Juries don't always get all the evidence. I could have made up my mind, thought, you know what, that doesn't matter what the barristers are going to say to me, that person is going to be whatever.
No, that's not what a judge would do. That's much more likely to be a juror.
But then you've got another. So yes. I mean, I've made up my mind. I've got 11 people. I've got another 11 people with another 11 every view in the world. And once you've gone through it all, almost line by line, with the directions from the judge.
Yeah.
I think we came to the right decision.
But with the directions from the judge, so why not just go straight to the judge?
Because the directions for the judge were all based on law.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the law, this is the law, this is what it is. But when you're sitting in a jury room, it's not just the law. You're looking at, how you feel about witnesses, whether they came across as truthful or not truthful, etc.
Yeah.
And some of these...
That's not necessarily doing what you want it to do as an argument, because, you know... But some people can lie very, very convincingly, and some people seem dishonest because they're really, really nervous. Yeah. I don't know that I want feelings to be playing a particular... I mean, a good cross-examination is what you would rely on to establish the reliability of a witness, not feelings.
But you've still got feelings as when
you're... Yeah, of course you do, but I think that's something I should... I mean, I think that's something I want taken out of the process, not put into it.
But you've got humans sitting there, so you can't always take out feelings.
No, I know, but the judge is more likely to be able to leave them at the door than anybody else in the room.
I'd have thought.
I mean, what would you be saying to me now if you had been as clear in your conclusions as you were, but the rest of the jury had gone the other way? What would you be saying to me now?
I'd still be saying the same thing, actually.
Would
because
you? Even though they got it wrong in your considered view.
In my considered view on the evidence we had, yes, but if the evidence had gone the other way...
Yeah, but it didn't. I'm talking about the evidence, I mean, them getting it wrong, and we know that juries do get it wrong.
As can judges.
Yes, so in terms of reducing the likelihood, most of the things you've said, Andrew, make me go the other way from the one that you were intending, actually. And I don't think it's because I'm in an ornery mood, because I'm not in an ornery mood. I'm in a lovely mood.
Yeah, I mean, I would still stick with... trial by jury.
Yeah, no, I know you would.
Having been there, sat there, and just think, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's definitely a better way of running a court system to cut down on the time, but I don't know what that is.
Well, I'm not sure there is, actually. That's why I opened the show by praising the people who are running Isleworth Crown Court, because they were doing such an incredible job in such difficult circumstances. But the logistics are inarguable. If you need a jury of 12 for every trial... The job of getting it all in order is absolutely, I mean, inconceivably difficult, and they do an incredible job in the circumstances. If I ask you a question, do you promise not to get offended?
No, that's fine, go.
Did it make you feel important?
You know what, I think it probably did, actually.
Mm.
I think sort of like, you go, whether that's a good or a bad thing.
I don't know whether it's a good or a bad thing or not. I guess I'm just cutting through what you've said to me and trying to sort of find a little nugget in the middle of it, at the heart of it all, about why you feel that it's of such great value.
I think all of my colleagues on the jury, I think we all started off at the beginning of the week. Yeah, it's sort of like quite frivolous. Lunch times were quite jovial.
Yeah.
And, we all seem to quite...
Yeah, but you took your responsibilities very seriously by the end.
As soon as you're sent out of court by the judge to go and make your deliberations, I can only talk about my one, but there was a marked change. When we walked back, we only walked back about 6 metres to our room, locked the doors verbally, and there was an absolute sea change in that room. And there was a bit of an atmosphere, and it was... We realised that as a group, that we were arguably the most important people in our defendant's life.
Yeah, absolutely. And oddly, I mean, as we sort of tried to walk the tightrope between facts and feelings, I get that. I understand that. And I think it's important. I think it's a democratic exercise in the purest sense of the word. It makes you feel part of society in a way that we very rarely... feel. I think it's the only thing we can be compelled to do. You don't have to vote, but you have to do jury service, unless you've got the mother of all excuses or explanations. Being a Z-list celebrity, for example, Andrew, didn't cut any mustard whatsoever when I tried to wriggle out of it. They weren't having any of it. I think they even said to me, proper famous people have to do jury service, so why on earth would we ever let you off? You have to do it, and that's a wonderful thing. But we're not doing away with all juries. But how can you possibly say it's a wonderful thing in that context, but we should abolish it in that context? I don't know. But I still think that I can. I'm afraid. Subscribe to supporting the idea until someone gives me a bigger zinger than we've managed to elicit so far. Andrew, thank you. It was a great call. Really helpful. It's 10:48.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
Keir Starmer delivers a speech to the country having cheered his Chancellor on in spending £16 billion more on benefits, that actually it's a moral mission to try and find a way of reducing that amount. He actually wasn't particularly committed to say he wanted to get the bill down, so I don't know what this reworking of the benefit system he wants that doesn't change the cost of it. A quarter of the working age population of this country is receiving benefits.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest, you probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
At Lathwaite's, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high, and low. And we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track, we certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at Lathwaites.co.uk. Lathwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
Train to Brighton with the besties. Immaculate vibes, as always. But I bet my ice skating is going to be pure chaos.
Oh, Em, you better hold my hand.
No, styled it out. I've got this.
Last one to the other side buys the hot chocolate.
Back on the train. Only fell twice.
Low-key legend.
We have to do this every year.
Download the Southern Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel and off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddy.
New In, the latest custom-fit rechargeable hearing devices. Discreet, comfortable and smart enough to help you catch every moment. Book a free hearing test at bootshearingcare.com. T's and C's apply.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad!
Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use.
Interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down, not off, said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with 3 tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 10:52 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where the imminent abolition of trial by jury in thousands of cases, more of a sort of reclassification than an abolition, it will simply remove the right to ask for a trial by jury in cases where you currently can. You know, there are various details that might inform your view, but the sense of what we're going to lose, the most powerful argument in favour of keeping it, is oddly, it's a slightly obtuse one, and I've lost it now, so I'll have to paraphrase it myself. So all of the arguments that we're hearing, of course, focus upon the proposal to abolish jury trials for lesser offences. And a lot of the arguments are it will be safer, it will be better to have a judge than a jury. So, I mean, surely that would cut the other way. If you're genuinely going to argue that a judge is preferable to a jury, then this should apply in the most serious cases. The luxury of a jury would be something that you'd only want to apply in the less serious cases. I may need a little bit more unpacking, but maybe the argument is not that a judge is better than a jury, that there's no difference at all In which case, well, then why keep them anywhere? Always reminded of that line in King Lear, when they're getting rid of his retinue, getting rid of his soldiers, and his two daughters are sort of competing over who can emasculate him the most. And he starts off with 100, and then they say 50. If you want to live with me, you can only have 20. And Lear is just watching this unfold with a sense of absolute horror, because he's given them his kingdom, and now they're taking away what little power he had held on to and presumed would be somehow inviolate. And at the end, one of them, I always forget which, Goneril or Regan, just says, what needs one? Why does he even need one staff member, one retinue, one soldier carousing around the country with him? And he suddenly realises just how bleak his situation is. And it's a sort of first creaking of his sanity. Why do you need one? So it's about the sort of cheese pairing principle. Once you start slicing things away, the likelihood of ending up with nothing increases. I don't know if that is applicable yet in this conversation, but it's where my mind's gone. If you're getting rid of jury trials for those defendants because reasons, why don't those reasons apply to those defendants over there charged with the really, really bad stuff, like murder and rape? Why? If all of those arguments are solid, how come they suddenly stop applying as you make your way up the seriousness scale? 10:54 is the time. Jim's in Leeds. Jim, what would you like to say?
James, you almost made me fall asleep there with your recital of King Lear. Anyway, back to business. We've spoken a few times now.
Outrageous.
Well, it's true. I won't go through my CV, but it's all about jury trials. I worked in a Crown Court for about 3 years as a dock officer, so I saw plenty of trials. And I was saying to your researcher or your producer, I would rather be judged by a judge. They're the expert. They're the one that studied for many, many years. And they're, like, as I say, the experts in their field, where you get jury members. When I was on my jury trial, one man sat there and he said, Jim, whatever you say, I'll go with you. I said, well, you can't. You have to have your own opinion. He said, no, I don't really know what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm happy to go with what you say. He knows what my previous job was as a prison officer. He said, I trust everything you say. They put me as the head honcho, if you like. People were sitting there and they actually had to ask the question of the judge. He says, no word of a lie. Who do we believe? Who are we supposed to believe?
Yeah, but one swallow does not a summer make, does it? Just, I mean, you know, people who can't appreciate the beauty of Shakespeare, to me, barely merit the oxygen that they breathe every day. But it doesn't mean I'd exclude them from jury service.
I get that. But when you're maybe sentencing somebody to the rest of their life, or let's say the most egregious, for me personally, most egregious crime you commit is a sexual crime against anyone, I'm not going to say children or adults.
No, of course,
it's the most vile of things. That's what my trial was for. The man involved was looking at double digits, only from previous experience. The judge confirmed that afterwards, and the people were sitting there saying, oh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. If you're not sure, you say, I don't know. And you go to the judge and say, I don't know, and he can decide if it goes down to majority or he'll go with disband the jury.
But I mean, what about the dilution effect, the fact that you've got 12 people and you cancel him out, so you're taking your responsibilities very seriously, he isn't, yep. And that's why you have 12 rather than one. Well, I mean, if you've got one judge who has had a bad day, or his wife's just left him, or he's, you know, he's lost a ton of money on a horse, or he's just found out that he's got cancer, or whatever it might be, if we're going to be operating in the realms of speculation, then that's 100. That's 100%. That's 100% of the decision maker who's been compromised by events. Whereas in your case, it's 1 in 12.
I take it back to the prison. In the prison, if say a prisoner gets caught with a mobile phone or drugs or something, the judge will come in from outside. They'll be judge and jury, and they'll give them additional time. They don't get a chance to actually. I don't want you to judge me, Your Honour. I want 12 people to come out from outside, 12 random people who maybe...
But now you're arguing the opposite. Now you're arguing the opposite of what you were arguing before. Now you're arguing about the strengths of just having one person sitting in jail.
No, I think you should have one person. I don't think...
Sorry, forgive me. No, you're not. You're not at all. You're making the same point twice.
I would say that I would want to be judged by a judge, purely by a judge.
I think I would as well. But I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, if I was innocent... How about this one? If I was innocent, I'd want to be judged by a judge. If I was guilty, I'd fancy my chances better with a jury.
I would go the opposite way still. I'd still be judged by a judge. Let's say you come into court, and they've stopped it now. I think I'm pretty sure they've stopped it. With handcuffs on. Because you're a little bit excitable down in the dock. Sorry, downstairs.
Yeah.
You come in with handcuffs on. Two or three dock officers. People straight away go, guilty.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a fight. So, all right, then. Why in our society have we attached such great reverence and respect to trial by jury then?
I think because it's such an old tradition, isn't it? So it's been going on for so many years now, 100 years as far as I know.
More than that. I mean, so it is just, why is it so valuable? Because we've always had it. And it may have been a lot easier to explain the value back in the day than it is now, but I'm still there. I mean, I don't have any really strong sense of loss when I read about the potential abolition of all of these juries.
People don't take it seriously, James, I'm sure you're aware. You don't, if you go to jury, if you're lucky enough that your company will pay your full salary, you'll get the money. If not, I think it works at about 80 or something pounds a day you'll get. So if you're on a very high salary, you're thinking, I don't care.
Tell me about it.
All you'll think about is how much money it's costing you.
My experience is different on that one. In that I had quite a lot of talks about this because people were fascinated by my situation when I was doing my jury service and I wasn't getting my wages covered. I mean, by any stretch of the imagination. And yet, I did actually quite like what Andrew was talking about in Havering, that sense of service, that sense of duty, which did actually infect the room, in exactly the way that Andrew described, albeit that I was never in the jury room, but even in the communal areas, you could watch people sort of almost straighten up a bit and take their responsibilities more seriously. And although some people were very hacked off, particularly self-employed people, about the financial penalty, it did dissipate. It diluted as the fortnight went past. It seemed to be less and less of an issue. But hey, I mean, that's just one perspective, isn't it? And so is yours. So yeah, I'm still where I was at the beginning of the hour. That doesn't happen that often.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, has confirmed another two prisoners are at large after they were released in error. He's revealed a dozen have been freed by mistake in the last 3 weeks, on top of 91 in England and Wales since April. The two missing inmates are not thought to be violent or sexual offenders. Mr. Lammy's told LBC there is a downward trend in mistakes.
We've got a paper-based system, as you know.
Yes.
We need to move to a digital system. I've asked Dame Lynn Owens to look at this and make some recommendations. I've put in a new digital crack team to help our prisons. There's been a bit of a misjoin between our courts and our prisons. I've put in a new query unit. The numbers are too high. There has been a spike.
The use of jury trials is expected to be scaled back as part of efforts to cut the court backlog in England and Wales. Mr. Lammy is expected to restrict them to more serious offences. New trials are currently being listed as far away as 2030. Fiona Rutherford, head of the legal reform group Justice, has told LBC there are better ways to drive efficiency.
In fact, there isn't a great deal of evidence to say that cutting back on jury trials is going to work in the first place. The sorts of solutions that the government, or that we would urge the government to consider further, is looking at how cases could be better managed and better prepared, investing in legal support and technology to enable the system to be quicker.
President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is due to meet Vladimir Putin in Moscow. It is the latest step in diplomatic activity aimed at brokering a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia. New forecast suggests UK inflation is set to remain among the highest in the G7. The OECD says it will top the list of advanced economies this year and remain second highest behind the US at 2.5% next year. The former England cricketer Robin Smith has died at the age of 62. The South African-born batsman, who capped in Hampshire, played more than 100 times for England between 1988 and 1996. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading up 30 points at 97.33. The pound buys $1.31 and a euro 13. LBC weather today feeling colder with sunny spells for many, some scattered showers developing in the south and west, a high of 11 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 3 minutes after 11. How many walkouts do you think there have been by doctors since March of 2023? The answer is 14, or rather 13, because the next one planned for December will be the 14th. There was a five-day strike last month, leading to warnings that the NHS may have to cut frontline staff and offer fewer appointments and operations if the strikes continue. Historically, I've always been minded to support striking doctors and striking teachers. With the caveat, with the very crucial caveat, that if you support every single strike, you're in danger of appearing almost as stupid as people who are opposed to every single strike. What do we want? Fewer rights for workers. Are you a worker? Yes. You're probably opposed to human rights as well, aren't you? Yes. Are you a human? Well, technically, I suppose I am, but I still don't think human rights... Anyway, I digress. So, historically and philosophically, let alone politically, I, perhaps naively, hold doctors and teachers in very high regard, and I think that when they tell us that they are in need of our support in order to secure better terms and conditions from our government, then I am minded to listen. I mean, the line I use about teachers, particularly when my children were at a state primary school, was that if I'm entrusting my children to these people at 8:30 every morning, then I'm minded, unless I'm given some incredibly compelling evidence that I shouldn't, I'm minded to trust them when they tell me that they've been left with little choice but to go on strike. If I can't trust them with that decision, how on earth can I trust them with my child? It's not a watertight argument there, and it's a little bit emotional, but it is one that I feel in my waters, which is why I'm sharing it with you. It's even more applicable to doctors, isn't it? Because you really are going to entrust a doctor with your life. You're going to entrust your life, your loved one, to doctors who are using their insights, their intelligence, their expertise and their training to arrive at a series of conclusions with regard to how they should treat you, how they should look after you. And again, at risk of sounding naive, they are deploying the same faculties, the same skill set, the same brain cells when deciding whether or not they are going to go on strike. And you don't become a doctor if you hold your patients in contempt. You don't become a doctor without some sense of, or you very, very rarely come across somebody who has become a doctor without any sense of duty or vocation. You know, whether it is a childhood experience that prompts you to decide that that is what you want to do for the rest of your life, or whether it is the matching of fates in that you develop or you display an affinity for certain disciplines while you're at school and realize that these are disciplines that would be best applied and most helpful both to you and to society if you were to become a medic, if you were to become a doctor. I am minded to support doctors when they tell me that they can go on strike. Um, 30% over the past 3 years is the rise that doctors have received. About 22% of that, well, 22% coming under the current government. But if you go back to 2008, this is the BMA's argument, and, you know, numbers are quite fluid figures. There will be interpretations of the same statistics that lead to different conclusions, and I am happy to hear them all today. But the argument from the BMA is that if you were to plot a graph from 2008, and I guess one of the things I mean when I talk about figures being fluid is that if you chose a different moment from which to plot that graph, the graph would probably look rather different. But they have chosen 2008, the moment, of course, of the global financial crisis, and they argue that if that graph of doctors' remuneration were to properly track inflation, then they would currently be 26% below where they should be. So in order to achieve parity with where they were in 2008, a workforce that has received almost 30% pay increase in the last 3 years would need another 26%, and they think they should get it. They think they should get it. Can I confide in you very briefly? Would you mind? I'm so conscious of the tiny number of voices in the UK media, and I'm not being self-important. Massive majority of people haven't got the first idea who I am. But, you know, for people who do, and the clips reach parts that the radio programme can't, I'm so conscious of the tiny number of voices in the UK media with an even half-decent-sized platform who will come out ever in support of striking. Well, it's not a coincidence, by the way. You're not going to be allowed to write a column in a Rupert Murdoch newspaper or the Daily Mail offering up passionate support for striking teachers or striking doctors. And if you are occasionally allowed to do it, it's more an exercise in editorial mischief than anything else. But I do sometimes feel a slightly self-important sense of responsibility to make the case. And I have to check myself. I have to make sure that I believe it. And that I'm not just doing it because the world and his wife across the rest of the UK media will be opposed to every single industrial action, regardless of who's taking it, even when it's journalists. I remember when Daily Express journalists were voting to go on strike, despite the fact that they would be professionally required whenever anybody else went on strike to attack the strikers. As a former journalist on the Daily Express, I was struck by that. It was a very different paper when I was there, but who knows whether I'd have had the opportunities to walk away after it fell into the clutches of yet another identikit central casting right-wing media owner. So I'm conscious of that. If I'm not going to stick up for the doctors, then who is? Which I fully accept. It sounds quite self-important. But that's who I... I'm always honest with you. That's where my brain goes. It's where my conscience goes, actually, on days like today. When the world and his wife is queuing up, or indeed the world and her husband, I think I talked about judges in the last hour, always in the he. I always went for the masculine, so apologies for that. It's just a sort of lazy stereotype. But anyway, the world and her husband are queuing up to attack doctors for going on strike and reaching for exactly the statistics that I just reached for. The 30% over the 3 years. 22% under this government. How dare they ask for more? And largely ignoring the other argument, which is that we're 26% below where we should be because inflation has gone up much faster. I'll tell you what would be an interesting exercise. If doctors had had a triple lock on their income, what would they be on now? Does anyone feel qualified to do that calculation? If doctors had had a triple lock on their pay rises, what would they be on now compared to what they are actually on? Is that the sort of thing AI might be able to help with, Keith? I don't know. We'll soon find out. 11 minutes after 11 is the time. I'm also, listen, while I'm confiding in you, okay, you're counselling me, whether you realise it or not. I'm also slightly worried about the amount of time these days that I tell you I haven't managed to arrive at a pungent opinion, that I am confused, that I am open to persuasion. I'm not sure that's what you tune in for. I think you tune in for a pungent opinion that you can then either agree with or bite holes out of. But I felt it the last time round, not the one that was last month, but when the current round, after the Labour government got in and the industrial actions were curtailed for a while with that very big pay rise, objectively speaking, it was a big pay rise, and we had about a year, didn't we, of peace. With like little, I think there was a report of someone in the BMA, there was a leak of a communication in which they said, give it a while and then we'll come back out again and they'll be really vulnerable. After they've been in power for a year, they'll be much more vulnerable than they are now. So we'll settle now and say that we're happy, but we'll come back for more in a year. And you can cast it like that. And the doctors emerge undeserving of your sympathy. And part of the reason I mentioned the triple lock is because it doesn't apply to anyone except pensioners. I don't think your wages are triple locked. I mean, one of the reasons why Rachel Reeves had a little bit better news from the OBR than she was originally given was because wages have gone up. And you think, hurrah! And then you read the next line in that sentence. It's not even a new sentence, because of inflation. So inflation goes up and wages track
inflation, or at least try to keep up with inflation, which means that wages go up, which means with frozen income tax thresholds, the tax take goes up as well. Because your wages are going up, even though you're not better off, you will be required to pay tax on more of your income, higher rates of tax on more of your income than you did before. That's economics, that is. So all of that comes into play here. And I don't know whether it should or not. Normally, when we're talking about workers' rights and somebody, like pensions, for example, and somebody says to me, well, I'm in the private sector and my pension has been completely kept. I don't have any pension at all. I mean, my employer doesn't even provide pensions anymore. So why the hell should firefighters get it? Or nurses? Or prisoners? And you sort of go, hang on a minute. This is an argument for you fighting back against your employer and demanding pension rights. It's not an argument for taking them away from the people who've still got them. I'm a taxpayer. I pay for public sector pensions. Yeah, but you're also someone who gets picked up by public sector ambulances and public sector fire engines will come to blow out the flames that are engulfing your house. You are a member of the public, and therefore you support the public sector and public services. They do not pay taxes to support whatever big industry or company it is that you work for, except, you know, educating the workforce and providing the roads that let you get to and from your business. You understand what I mean? The public sector should be perceived as differently from the private sector. And if private bosses have been able to mistreat their staff, it's not an argument that the public sector should be able to do so as well. So I'm not always drawn to the idea that the experiences in the private sector should inform the experiences with the public sector. All of which, as if you listen to this program on a regular basis, you have probably already worked out, leads me to very reluctantly suggest that this strike's not on. This strike's not on. Unless we can cling on to the specialness of doctors, unless we can make the societal argument that it doesn't matter how much people working in Morrison's are earning or how much the hospitality industry is being hit by a variety of problems, a civilized society looks after its doctors, and all they are asking for... I'm talking myself out of it now. All they are asking for is parity with where they were in 2008. And anybody who has benefited from the ministrations of the NHS in the last few years will know that telling those professionals, telling those doctors that they are being generously rewarded or that they should be grateful for what they've got is a rather hard act to pull off. So when I compare doctors to pretty much everybody else in the country except pensioners, which is not, by the way, an abuse of pensioners, when I compare doctors to everybody else in the country and say they don't deserve a pay rise, I'm treating doctors like everybody else in the country. And I don't know that we should. It seems to me, particularly if we're going to buy into that hideous rhetoric of training our own, and again, like King Canute, I don't think that we are going to be able to turn back some of those tides of bigotry and exceptionalism and nativism. If we are serious about replacing foreign doctors with British-born and British-trained doctors, then you need to make the profession as attractive as possible, particularly compared to overseas options, because doctors are increasingly weighing up their opinions in other countries, in other health sectors, elsewhere in the world. So, doctors are saying to you, we need to go on strike, we need more pay. Politicians, including the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, are saying to you, we've already given them 30% over the last 3 years, 22% since we got into power, and that was only 10 minutes ago. They really, really need to calm down, give their heads a wobble and get back to work. What are you saying to me? 03456060973. Sorry that I've kind of done a terrible BBC thing here and given you two quite well-argued positions that are in direct contravention of each other. But sometimes that's the correct way to approach things. Has anyone done the calculation yet on what doctors would be earning if their wages had been triple locked since 2008? That might be quite intriguing, just out of curiosity as well. But just as we had lawyers populating the discussion about jury service, so I'd quite like doctors, whether you're striking or not, to tell me whether or not this five-day strike action in the immediate run-up to Christmas, from the 17th of December to the 22nd of December, whether or not you are in favour of it or against it. And it's funny, isn't it? We talked about punters, potential or otherwise, in the last hour, because any of us could find ourselves in the dock. Any of us could find ourselves in the jury room at any time. The same could not be truer of hospital, could it? Whether you've been to the doctors in the last week, month or year or not. Maybe you've not been for 2 decades. You could be there tomorrow. You could be in A&E tomorrow. Do we want our doctors to turn up at work every day feeling more valued than they currently do? Well, yes. Do we support the strike? Well, no, not necessarily. How can you hold both of those positions at the same time? 11:18 is the time. I've got a sneeze. Would you believe it? That's quite medical, isn't it? That's quite appropriate. That's happened again. That's twice in the last 2 months. I've had a sneeze just beginning in the depths of my nostrils, and then it's disappeared. I really want to sneeze on air. I don't know why. I just think it would be really fun. I've never done it before. There's very few things I've never done on air. Yeah, all right, matron, calm down. There's very few things I've never done on air, but sneezing is probably near the top of the list. Anyway, if that's not digression enough, here we are. Doctors are going on strike again. I've got 2 questions for you. The first is obvious. Do you support it? Do you support it? I couldn't arrive at a conclusion in the last hour, and I really want to. And by 12 o'clock today, I want to be either in favour of or against the latest round of industrial action by our doctors. And I'm not even joking when I tell you that I'm currently 52-48. I'm 52-48 against, because I'm comparing them to everybody else in the country. As soon as I think maybe I shouldn't be doing that, I'm 52-48 in favour. What are you and why? 0345-6060-973. And given that we're now looking at the 14th walkout since March of 2023, how have you been affected by the previous strikes? Because I've got a feeling they're not as effective as... I mean, you don't want them to be effective, really, because that would involve people's care being compromised. But it's kind of important as to the efficacy or the salience of the strikes themselves. So, question for everybody, 0345-6060-973. Do you support the latest rounds? And I'm particularly interested if, like me, you supported previous ones, but you're not sure about this one. Or if you're absolutely adamant that it's 100% right or 100% wrong, you're my favourite callers, 0345-6060-973. And a little bit more specific, how have you been affected by previous ones? How actually has it impacted upon you? And don't say not at all, because I didn't have any appointments. If you had an appointment and it wasn't affected, that is interesting. If you had an appointment planned or something and it was affected, that is also interesting. The number remains the same. The time is 11:21.
This is LBC.
At Laithwaite, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high, and low, and we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf, we don't go there. Off the beaten track, we certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at laithwaites.co.uk. Laithwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income, and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 991234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
At Morrison's, we're serving up something a little bit indulgent for Christmas. Pick up the best baked feta made with Greek feta cheese, creme fraiche, smoky Spanish chorizo and hot honey. Approved by Good Housekeeping. Ooh, tasty. Morrison's, making more of Christmas. Majority of stores online. Offers and prices may vary online and in Morrison's daily.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
22 minutes after 11 is the time. I think we've got some dispute over what the doctor's salary would look like in the event of a triple lock. Keith's had a go. He thinks it would be about 40% higher than it is now if the doctor's income had been triple locked in the way that the old age pension is. I don't know how helpful this is. It just occurred to me that it's an angle I haven't seen explored before. in terms of telling doctors that they should suck it up and that it doesn't matter that their wages are 26% lower than where they would be if their wages had kept pace with inflation since 2008. Again, that's a movable feast, and you should feel free to move it. But there's a natural injustice to that. You sign up for a job in expectation of a wage. You expect the wage to keep track with inflation, and it doesn't. What recourse are you left with? What can you do in response to that scenario except withdraw your labour to a degree? Doctors, of course, can't withdraw labour in quite the same way that other workforces can. Hospitals have to stay open. But why does it feel like this one is a strike too far? I've got some phone lines free. Hit the numbers now, you will get through. Dave is in Blackburn. Dave, what would you like to say?
Good morning, James. You okay?
Very well, mate. What's on your mind?
So, I mean, I just find it... Obviously, I appreciate doctors and what they do, but they, for you, for example, James, when you was either offered the position for LBC or you applied for it,
yeah,
was you aware of what the salary would be?
I know what the offer was, but my wages have kept track with inflation and the rest for over 20 years now. So that's not quite the zinger you thought it was going to be.
Mm, yeah, you sort of stumped me there.
Oh, that was easy.
I'm self-employed, so if I don't, yeah, if I don't work, I don't get paid, sort of thing. But
of course, same here, actually, for the record, same here. I mean, I'm paid on PAYE, but if I don't turn up, I don't get paid.
Yeah. Well, you stumped me, James. I've nothing else to say, mate.
But that's all right. So it is simply you would expect your wage that you agreed as a member of staff to keep pace with inflation, and it hasn't. So I haven't just stumped you. You're actually in favour of the strike.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, you are.
Mm.
Under the terms of your own logic, they should get the deal they signed up for in 2008, which was wages that keep track with inflation.
But, I mean, it's the same with sort of any industry that you go into university for now, James. I mean, think of all these poor kids that have spent all these fees on being sort of graphic designers or...
Yeah, but why am I thinking about them? I'm thinking about doctors. I don't need to think about them. I mean, I can appreciate two things at the same time, the plight of doctors and the plight of people whose qualifications have been rendered obsolete by technology and social change. If I was a doctor and I'd trained for 10 years and I'd gone in 2005 and I'd reached 2025 and I'm 26% below where I fully and reasonably expected to be, what will I do if not go on strike?
You're a gentleman and a scholar.
Come on. Be more Dave. 0345 6060973. Because, oddly, you know, I start persuading myself that I'm in favour of the strike. I'm still 52-48% against it for the reasons that Dave largely addresses, which is a sense that now is not the time. But if not now, then when? When is the time? 26%, and feel free to challenge these figures, because I know that they are challengeable. I just haven't got the figures in front of me. The 26% increase over the next few years that would make up for the erosion in their pay that has taken place in real terms due to inflation since 2008. That's the BMA's argument. So there's two bits of homework for you. What would happen if their wages had been triple locked since 2008? And what happens if you move that date, that starting date, if you move it a little bit backwards or a little bit forwards, does the figure of 26% come down so their plight looks less sympathetic? Phil's in Oxford. Phil, what do you think?
Hey, James.
Hello, Phil.
I'm 70-30 against,
okay,
having been 100% for prior to the election.
Yes.
The reason for my movement, my support has declined since then, is simply the 22% redress that the Labour government paid,
yeah,
very quickly upon getting into power. So that's got the doctors to a much better position. Not an ideal position, not a perfect position.
So you're being political. You're being political. You're sort of thinking the government, and it's not often we say this about any government, the government did as much as they could, as quickly as they could, to address this real grievance.
I'd like to think that.
Yeah.
I don't have the insight to be absolute about that.
No, of course.
No one does but them. But yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And therefore, and clearly when the government agreed it, they thought that they were putting it to bed for a little bit longer than a year.
Yeah.
Or rather, a lot longer than a year.
Yeah, and it wouldn't surprise me that those conversations were had at the time, with the BMA. So, you know, please now bear with us. We'll do as best we can, as quickly as we can.
There's some sort of commitment in place, oddly. Jay picks up on this. Is it possible that Streeting is partially at fault to give 22% with no guarantees of a short to medium term commitment not to strike was careless? Surely a 3-year plan in place in return for the 22% that they provided of the 30% they've had in the last 3 years could have come with a bit of a quid pro quo.
Yeah, I think if it had been formalised, guaranteed, then right, yeah, and I think Streeting could be criticised for that quite rightly. However, the other big factor here is the doctors, I believe, anecdotally, are losing the support of the majority of people in the country over this. And that's a dangerous place for them to get themselves to, I think. So, yeah, all in, I can't support it. The 30% is that I want to. I love doctors. My life has been saved a number of times by the glory of NHS. And I'm a very firm supporter, but I just cannot now get behind this, given the economic realities we're going through. And it's as simple as that.
And it is not, I mean, unless you were to sort of buy into the Faragist abuse of refugees and asylum seekers, which, of course, would be negligible in the context of NHS spending. But what I'm saying is we can't easily point at anything where we can say, why don't they stop spending money on X and spend it on doctors instead?
No, I don't think so.
Too intelligent to do that, probably. Thank you, Phil. It is coming out to 11:30. So that's 2-0, 2-0. I mean, maybe did Dave a bit of a disservice, actually, because if you were signing up to be a junior doctor in 2008... in expectation of certain rewards, would you still be a junior doctor now, looking at the same pay deal, looking at the same percentages? It's probably a little bit more nuanced or a little bit more complicated than my deft demolition of his position allowed. But hey, if I'm missing stuff, it's your job to put the flesh on the bones, which is another agreeably medical image, isn't it? Here's Thomas Watts with your headlines.
12 more prisoners have been mistakenly freed in the past month, and 2 are still at large. That's on top of the 91 accidental releases between April and the end of October. The Justice Secretary has told LBC that jury trials will remain a cornerstone of the court system. David Lammy is expected to announce plans to limit juries to more serious criminal cases in England and Wales. The inquiry into the murder of Sarah Everard is set to publish further findings about women's safety in public places. The Angelina inquiry was set up after the 33-year-old was killed by an off-duty police officer in March 2021. LBC weather feeling colder today with sunny spells for many and some scattered showers in the south and west. A high of 11 degrees.
This is LBC.
When you're smiling,
don't let missing teeth stop you smiling. At Banning Dental, our experts could restore your beautiful smile with premium dental implants. See online for our price match promise. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling. Keep on smiling. And the whole world smiles with you.
Banningdental.co.uk.
At Laithwaite, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high. And low. And we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track? We certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at laithwaites.co.uk. Laithwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
The congestion charge helps to reduce traffic in central London. To ensure it remains effective while incentivising the switch to electric vehicles, from the 2nd of January, electric cars will be charged a 25% discounted rate of £13.50 rather than the new daily charge of £18. To receive the discount, electric cars must be registered on AutoPay. Further discounts are available for other electric vehicles. Search TfL AutoPay. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
This Friday's EuroMillions jackpot will have you dancing like nobody's watching. Yeah, baby. Just make sure nobody is watching. Get in this Friday's EuroMillions draw. Play on app.
Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Protect your pets over this festive period.
visit petsinapickle.co.uk and enjoy Christmas covered.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
33 minutes after 11, and it's not anecdotal. NHS leaders, senior doctors, the GMC have warned that the increased denigration and abuse directed at migrants in the UK was a significant reason for a measurable rise in the numbers of overseas trained doctors quitting the UK. We know that the British-born doctors are increasingly tempted by other health services, language barriers being what they are. Australia is a particular destination of choice. And you've also got what I think you could only really describe as self-inflicted problems. So the iPaper reported recently on the sort of people, junior doctors, who worry that they won't have a job at all next year because of anomalies and problems within the system. And most of this, of course, is missing from most of the coverage. And I guess we can do something, hopefully, to redress that in our own small way. Megan is in Tooting. Megan, what would you like to say?
James, hello, I just wanted to say I'm a resident doctor. I'm coming to the end of my SHO training, it's called, and next I'll be a registrar. I'm applying for that now. And I'm not striking for me or pay. I'm really striking for the future of the profession and really the NHS. You know, we go into medicine for lots of different reasons. I do say we sacrifice a lot. I've sacrificed in my teens and my 20s of the amount of I've spent of my own money on exams, because that's not funded, is eye-watering. But I want to work in the NHS. I don't want to work privately, but really that is what my seniors are telling me to do, to think about how I can make myself really commercially viable to go into a private
healthcare. Why do you want to work in the NHS?
Honestly, your colleagues are incredible. You always have a good day, and you really can help people, and even just small kindnesses from your colleagues when you're having a really busy day mean the world. But I'm not even kidding, we don't have chairs. We have to stand at computers writing really long reports or discharge letters. There's nowhere really for us to have lunch. You have windowless tiny rooms. It feels like you're clinging on to these bright parts of the NHS, and they're slowly dimming.
So the coverage is somewhat disingenuous then? I mean, presuming that you speak for many of your colleagues, you're worried about the circumstances, the terms and conditions that people who might join today are going to endure, rather than necessarily impositions upon your own packages.
Yeah, I don't think that they're going to get the opportunities to train to be consultants, because the numbers just aren't there. So many of my colleagues aren't getting into those next steps of training, so they're stuck. And
why,
you know,
is that? Why is that? Forgive me, I should know more about this, but I genuinely don't. Why is that? Because nobody thinks of the NHS as being overstaffed, really, at the moment.
So for any type of medicine, surgery, psychiatry, GP, there's only certain numbers that can be trained because of the funding that gets given from the top down to each local area. So you can only fund so many places, and that funding goes into paying for, you know, us to have some teaching every week, you know, us to have a supervisor that's directly supporting our growth and development. So if you can't get one of those posts that are almost like gold dust, then, you know, you might think, oh, why don't I just go to Australia or go into another industry, because you've got no guaranteed career.
But that's not going to change with a pay rise.
No, but part of the strike is not just pay rise. It's about increasing those training numbers. And that's not been talked about as much in the media, but that's
funny,
the main reason me and my colleagues are striking, because of the training posts.
That's a little bit like a cloud disappearing from the sky for me, and everything becoming a little bit clearer. Because if it were as simple as saying, we've had 30% over the past 3 years and that's not enough, albeit with your very helpful analysis of, well, it's not really me that I'm worried about, it's the people joining the profession. But actually, to move beyond that into the training places, and this weird thing that I don't think the average punter has quite got their head around, 12,743 training posts available in 2024, with about 25,000 people applying for them. Mm. That's graduates both domestic and international. That's madness.
Exactly. And you're competing with the international graduates as well. My dad's a medic that came from abroad to study in the UK. They're so important for our workforce. But we're adding to the number of medical students every year, but we're not giving them opportunities to, you know, be able to go up that ladder.
And is that because we are benefiting from other countries paying for the training of other people who then come here and join our NHS, and we haven't had to fund their training, or not?
Exactly. I mean, the other part of it is, in the UK to apply, you need lots of other things alongside your degree. You need special projects. You need to publish in, you know, all these different journals. Extra qualifications like a master's in education is always wanted. And if you come from another country, perhaps you've been able to do a lot of those things and you're coming a lot later in your career, maybe in your late 30s compared to your early 20s, like the UK graduates. So why would the NHS not pick these, you know, people who are slightly more qualified to do these roles?
And free, in the great scheme of things. Can you stay there? Because Mike, I think I know what Mike is going to say, and I was going to nick it and pass it off as my own, but that wouldn't be very fair on Mike. So I'm going to let him make a point, and then I'd like you to respond to it. Is that okay?
Yeah, I'll see what I can do.
Thank you. Mike's in Dunstable. Mike, what would you like to say? Briefly, if you would.
Withdraw the pay claim element of the dispute,
yes,
and lead on recruitment of doctors and nurses and filling all these places, because it's a really important issue. We've got a lot of people who, I understand, have done like 2 or 3 years of basic training, can't get into specialisms because it's not being funded. That's
You're speaking to exactly the same problem, but in sort of public opinion terms, Megan, Mike's point is powerful, isn't it? In that if this strike was clearly and only about the thing you've cited as the main grievance, I wouldn't be getting messages like the one I'm getting from Rich, which says, I've supported every Tube teacher and doctor strike in recent years, but I can't get behind this one.
No, Mike makes a really good point. And, you know, for whatever reason, my union, the BMA, this is what they're going for. And, you know, in some ways, I have to trust them.
So you possibly might have been happier if they'd gone down the route Mike describes at this point in the cycle, in the process, or not?
I think I might have been more enthusiastic if it had just been about the training post.
Well, thank you. That's so helpful. And it's really honest of you as well, because I could tell from Mike's question, he didn't think that he was sort of kebabbing you or zinging you or leaving you with nowhere to go. But I don't know that either of us quite expected that level of grace in terms of, yep, that's absolutely right. I'm on strike, and I'd probably rather be on strike in slightly different circumstances from the ones that I am on strike under, but I wasn't offered that choice.
Exactly.
Megan, thank you. All right, 51-49. 51-49. Mike, what did you think of that answer?
I think it is very open and honest.
And it leads back to the BMA, doesn't it, really? And the idea that they are not necessarily winning the communications war, even if they might have won the rhetorical war or the philosophical war. If most punters knew, I mean, let me read all of Rich's message. I can't get behind this one because I think it drips with a lack of self and public awareness for where we are currently as a country. If it was clear or clearer that either none of it was about pay rises or that a lot of it was not about pay rises, then the needle of public opinion would probably be moving rather more than it currently is.
I would have to support Rich. Many years ago, I was a civil servant and in the 80s, and we regularly put in pay claims on the basis that in the past we were paid more.
Okay, phone line's gone south, unfortunately. I think the point being, as you said, you've chimed with Rich, which is not now. Not now, nurse, perhaps, would be, or doctor would be the distillation of what you've described. I think that we're hugely unaware about some of the issues that doctors are facing, not least that simple statistic there on training contracts or on the training posts that are available, oversubscribed to over 100%. And non-UK trained, international graduates applying in even greater numbers than UK graduates. So, you know, the borderline racist, why don't we train our own brigade, should really be getting their knickers in a twist about this as well and coming out in favour of the doctor's strike. But it's very odd, isn't it, how one prejudice almost always coexists with another. Niamh is in Kingston-upon-Thames. Niamh, what would you like to say?
Hi, James.
Hello.
I'm a resident doctor, and I'm calling because I'm actually on the other end of the issue from Megan. So I've just finished my first 2 years of training, and I'm currently at that sort of like bottleneck point where you either sort of do specialty training or if you're lucky enough, and then if not, find something else to do.
What are the something else's? Just out of interest.
There's options which are becoming very rare and few and far between, especially training, which include clinical fellow jobs, where you can go into sort of a 60-40 of working on the shop floor and then teaching in universities. They're very rare. Or you can locum, which is what I'm trying to do. So I'm on the bank for two different hospitals in my area. And when I first moved back home from where I was doing my foundation training, I only managed to get three shifts across both A&Es in an entire month.
Oh, wow. I mean, a lot of people listening are going to find that almost impossible to understand, let alone believe.
Yeah.
And yet that's the reality that you're and many of your cohorts are dealing with.
Yeah, and I'm so incredibly lucky that I've come home to supportive parents who are happy to have me here.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't under the pressure of having to pay bills immediately, but yeah, it was. And it's not that they don't need us, and it's not that the departments don't want us there, it's just there's not the money to pay us, so they can't bring us in.
This is part of the rationale for the strike, but most people listening to this are hearing it for the first time this hour.
Yeah, and I think that was my main pickup from the first sort of 15 minutes of your show, was that actually
he doesn't know what he's talking about.
No. it's more that like it's peddled, isn't it, that pay is the big thing that we're all thinking about, and I think that lots of my friends and colleagues in my position, you know, 52% of us are in the same position as me, like more than half of us are facing this issue.
The infernal ratio rears its ugly head once again. What happens next to that 52%? So 10,000 people get the training contracts, of which just shy of 13,000 get the training posts, of which a significant proportion are going to be international graduates. You've described some of the other options that are open to you. You can't survive. You can't carry on indefinitely on three shifts a month. So what happens next? What are the worst case scenarios for the thousands of young people in your position?
So you either diversify and you sort of go and sort of locum for more hospitals or more specialties in a hospital if you can, or you do what I'm doing, which I'm really nervous to say on the radio, but I'm going to Australia in January.
Why are you nervous of saying that?
It's really difficult because a lot of people have quite mixed views of it.
You've only got three shifts last month.
I know. And
what else are you going to do? This is what we're streeting seems to be unaware of. I mean, to defend myself, I don't always, in fact, I rarely turn to The Guardian first to get my coverage of issues like this. I prefer to get a slightly broader perspective. But The Guardian doesn't mention any grievance except pay, as far as I can tell, over the course of the... Well, no, it does. The government failing to... I tell a lie. Jack Fletcher, chair of the BMA. With the government failing to put forward a credible plan to fix the jobs crisis for resident doctors at the same time as pushing a real terms pay cut for them, we have no choice but to announce more strike dates. But, of course, once it's been through the mangle of the media, it's all about wages, isn't it? And that's the media's fault. It's not even necessarily the BMA's fault. Unless, and I wonder how you would feel about this, unless they took Mike's advice and actually detached this industrial action from the wage situation and focused entirely upon the jobs and training situation.
Exactly. I think not that pay restoration isn't important in the long term, but I think that the more crushing and crucial issue is, as Megan was saying, it's not just the issue that it is right now that we've got, you know, sort of 30,000 applications for 10,000 jobs. It's what that creates in the future. Like, you're not creating the consultants of tomorrow. And that is going to cause real issues for patients down the line, where we're diversifying the NHS workforce, including physician's assistants and advanced nurse practitioners who need direct consultant supervision. They're not going to have that in 10 years' time because you're not creating those consultants.
This is beginning to settle. I'm a bearer of very little brain, but and of course, two resident doctors do not an entire workforce make. But this idea that the real grievance for your people in your situation is not pay restoration today, it might be the day after tomorrow, metaphorically speaking, but the real grievance is this hideous situation where you can't find work, even though you've taken out an immense amount of debt and worked extremely hard in full expectation of some degree of job security, and there's no certainty of job, let alone security.
Yeah, and it's only going to get worse. This year is the first year where not all graduating UK doctors from university got a foundation training job. About 200 of them were left unemployed.
Yeah, I read about that.
They created the places, but not the jobs to put them in when they graduated.
So this is exactly the line of questioning that West Streeting should really be facing, but equally so should the BMA.
Yeah.
And you are, like Megan, striking, albeit that you'd rather be striking under a slightly different, well, a very different banner, one that doesn't, at this stage, doesn't even mention pay restoration.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
It's sad, because I love my job, and a lot of us do, and I wouldn't want to do anything else, but I just don't know if I'd look back and tell 17-year-old me that it's the wisest career move that she could make.
Isn't that poignant? Thank you, and good luck, seriously. And you know, you do what's best for you. That's what everybody else does, and what was best for you used to be staying in the NHS. It's not your fault. That isn't the truth anymore. Three shifts in a month. Go on, riddle me that. And everyone's getting their knickers in a twist, me included, about wages. I told you sometimes when I do the BBC thing and offer up what I hope is a balanced position in defence of two conflicting sides, it can sometimes be the most illuminating way of all into subjects. And it has been today, because this debate to me feels now completely different from how it felt just under an hour ago.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
I can bring into the conversation the Justice Secretary, Deputy Prime Minister. David Lammy joins me now. How many offenders are currently at large? Do you know? Do you have the number?
Two. I can't tell you the circumstances.
Well, are we going to find them? I want to help you find them. No. I want to be able to put out their descriptions now, live on LBC. Nick. You know how LBC works. I don't need to remind you of the heft of this great organisation, Mr. Lammy.
Just so I can give you the facts, we've got a paper-based system, as you know.
Yes.
We need to move to a digital system.
But how long have these two been on the lam, Mr. Lammy?
That I've already...
Oh, please, God, you know which jail they're from. But.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app. Or the new LBC app.
The congestion charge helps to reduce traffic in central London. To ensure it remains effective while incentivising the switch to electric vehicles, from the 2nd of January, electric cars will be charged a 25% discounted rate of £13.50 rather than the new daily charge of £18. To receive the discount, electric cars must be registered on AutoPay. Further discounts are available for other electric vehicles. Search TfL AutoPay. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
Oh, Black Friday is non-stop. Orders, calls, messages.
Sounds like you need the right sidekick to keep business booming, Claire.
Go on.
In EE's Black Friday sale, you can save £720 on a 36-month plan with the Samsung Galaxy S25 Ultra. Perfect for keeping your business running smoothly.
What a deal. Thanks, Kev.
Search EE Business today. BT and EE, better for business.
Excludes 20% VAT, ends 4th of December. Terms apply.
They live in you.
A spectacle far beyond your imagination.
They live in me.
Be amazed. Be moved.
They're watching over.
Be there.
Everything we see.
For an experience that will stay with you forever.
In every creature.
Disney's The Lion King.
In every star.
At London's Lyceum Theatre.
They live in you.
Book now at thelionking.co.uk.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad!
Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use,
interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down, not off, said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with three tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It's 11:53. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. That's a funny one, isn't it? All roads lead here, really. James writes, Chris, no media has ever asked ministers about training and other issues, only money, which surely influences the public. So, guilty. Right? I mean, I don't generally have politicians on the programme from the government, not for any particular reason. I'm sure they'd be happy to appear, unlike the last lot. But the generally other colleagues take up that particular sort of form of work. Hopefully they'll take this on board. That's not a criticism of anybody, by the way, because I literally began this interlude by saying guilty. As I took the guidance from The Guardian this morning on what the strike is about, and I sort of scan it, read it very cursorily, focus on the numbers, get to the bottom of the story, 30% over 3 years, 22% under Labour, BMA arguing that 26 more. Dig into it a little deeper, read it a little bit more carefully, and you discover that the offer that they are complaining about is not just about pay. They are failing to make a, quote, credible offer on jobs or pay. Chair of the BMA's Resident Doctors Committee, with the government failing to put forward a credible plan to fix the jobs crisis for resident doctors, at the same time as pushing a real terms pay cut for them, we have no choice but to announce more strike dates. So however you dice that, the strike is more about the jobs crisis than it is about pay restoration. And yet, hand on heart, how many people realised that before we started this conversation? I think the answer is very, very few. But that may be me doing an exercise in backside covering, because I'm guilty of this. And I do this for a living, and I like to think I pay attention. And I even knew some of the stuff that's popped up today, some of the stuff that Megan was telling us about and others. But here we are. It's not a strike about pay. Or it's certainly not a strike exclusively about pay. It's not even a strike mainly about pay. But that is how most public opinion is going to be informed, or at least most public opinion is going to be based on the idea that it is. Charlie's in Worthing. Charlie, what would you like to say?
Hello, James.
Hello,
Charlie. Good morning. I just wanted to reiterate what the last couple of callers said, actually. I'm a resident doctor. I will be striking, and I'm very conflicted about it. For me, it's not currently about pay either. I think that the pay uplift was really welcomed and is a very good start. But what was discussed also at this time over a year ago now, when Labour got in, was that there was going to be plans made for the training opportunities for more junior doctors, and also to improve working conditions, especially in frontline services. And over a year on, none of those plans have even been really put forward, let alone become concrete
And this would be almost, if we were to speculate on what Wes Streeting is playing at, he's almost benefiting from the media failure to be more nuanced and more informed, and encouraging a focus entirely upon pay, because that's the only way he can wriggle off the hook that you've just described him being on.
I would say so. I think it's also a bit disingenuous for the for Wes Streeting to be kind of putting into the media things like he's talking now about doubling the training posts. He's not. He's talking about doubling the extra training posts, which would still only amount to 2,000 a year when we have,
which is a drop in the ocean, but it's not an ocean. It's far from an ocean.
It needs to be it needs to be multiplied by 10 to start having a real impact.
And
I think this is what the media gets presented from the government, and it's the line that they then take.
I wonder what the numbers would be. I mean, do you think the BMA have missed a trick by tucking pay restoration onto this, or would it not have got the numbers? Would it not have got the mandate if it had been exclusively about training posts and jobs?
I don't know.
No, I know you don't know. I'm going to force you to answer.
All right. My feeling would be that
You're not on duty now. You can speculate to your heart's content. I don't need a diagnostic analysis.
All right. So I feel that I would have been far less likely to have voted for the mandate to strike if there had been a credible 3 to 5 year gradual pay uplift alongside a definite plan. This is what we're going to do to increase the training numbers.
Yeah.
Because they've been increasing student places for years.
Right.
And they've not been increasing the training provision. And I'm now looking at, I'm looking at getting to consultant level in about 3 or 4 years. I'm now worried about there being enough consultant jobs need to go in.
Just in a sentence, I know we've already answered this question, but why is that? How do you account for that extraordinary state of affairs that you approach that? I mean, it was never quite enough post, was there, for every single person that wanted to be a consultant, but it's never been as bad as this, or is even that bit wrong?
No, it's looking, I think I'm not entirely certain. No. I think, it's never been entirely the case that there's 100% posts, no. But it's looking quite poor, and it's looking like it's going to get worse.
And why? Too simplistic a question.
It might be a bit simplistic. I don't think departments are expanding fast enough. I mean, I work for I'm an emergency doctor.
Right.
My Royal College has been warning successive governments for the past 2 decades about the increasing number of patients turning up at hospitals. And we've predicted really accurately what that goes up by every year. Now, if you don't increase the service provision for that, what you end up with is not enough doctor roles to cover the jobs. But what they've then looked at then, what has then happened is they've been increasing student training places for medical students. And now you're going to end up, what we're starting to get is a glut of junior doctors with no training posts. And what we're now looking down the road at is a glut of middle grade registrars with no consultant posts to go to.
And they're going to be at the front of the queue to get out of the country entirely, inevitably.
Yeah, many of my colleagues have gone over the past few years. It's been a real shame.
So I think that's another misconception. So you say to me, I'm moving to Australia, which is the obvious destination to be a doctor, but Canada, there's lots of other places as well. Yeah. If you've got the languages, the world's your oyster. But we think, oh, it's because of the weather, or it's because it's nicer, or it's because of this or that or the other. In fact, in many cases, I literally can't get a job in the UK. Yeah. That's why I'm going, because I literally can't get a job. Yeah.
And also, pay is part of it as well.
Of course
it
is.
Also the way that you get treated. Also the way that you get treated and training prospects. You go to Australia as an emergency medic, the training prospects are brilliant.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
The working hours are much better. The working conditions are much better. I'm not going because I'm kind of tied to the country for various reasons. But had I gone into university at 18 rather than in 30-something, I probably would have already left.
Yeah, and the Daily Mail would be blaming it on Rachel Reeves. At least some things are certain and constant in this world. Thank you. What an extraordinary bunch of callers, and what a lovely bunch of people as well. All of those resident doctors appeared to be, and how appallingly they have been served by successive governments, and indeed by my profession, and I think with a little bit of defence based upon the fact that we got there in the end, by me as well. A lot of messages coming in like this from James. I was 80-20 against the doctor's strike after listening to your calls from resident doctors. I'm now 90-10 in support and would be 100% if the BMA had removed pay restoration from this stage of the dispute. And Daniel in Milton Keynes, this hour has been very enlightening. I was 52-48 against the strikes before, thinking it was all about pay. But after learning about the lack of training places for UK graduates in the medical field, my pendulum has firmly swung in the other direction to 90-10 in favour of strike action. And that, I think, without being too cocky, we could probably do that to the whole country if we had the right conversation in the right place in front of the right people. Fat chance.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the inquiry into Sarah Everard's murder has warned of a troubling lack of momentum in preventing attacks against women. The Angiolini inquiry was set up after the killing of the 33-year-old by a serving police officer in March 2021. LBC's Fraser Knight has more details.
The inquiry chair says basic questions like how many women have been raped in a public place couldn't be answered, as she warned that new approaches to prevent attacks won't work unless they're given proper resources. Despite police being told 2 years ago to tackle violence against women with the same urgency that they do terrorism, this report says right now that's not happening.
The Home Office has previously said it's delivering a step change to halve violence against women and girls. It's been revealed 12 more prisoners have been mistakenly freed in the past 3 weeks. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy's, confirmed two are still missing. He says they are not violent or sexual offenders, but has declined to give further details. Mr. Lammy is due to set out plans to cut the number of jury trials in England and Wales. They're expected to be reserved for more serious cases as part of efforts to cut the huge backlog in criminal cases. Some trials are being listed for 2030 because of the pressure on the system. LBC's political editor is Natasha Clark.
We don't know all the details of what David Lammy is about to announce. There was a leak to a few newspapers a couple of weeks ago, to the Times newspaper, which suggested that David Lammy might be about to restrict jury trials to only very serious offences like murder, manslaughter and rape. However, there has been some reports out today that that might be watered down a little bit.
Vladimir Putin is due to host the US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff for a meeting in Moscow. President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is also expected to attend the talks on ending the war in Ukraine. The White House says it's very optimistic about reaching a deal. The former England cricketer Robin Smith has died at the age of 62. The South African-born batsman played more than 100 times for England in the 1980s and 90s. The ECB says he gave fans enormous pride and no shortage of entertainment. In the city, the FTSE 100, a short time ago, was trading up 35 points at 97.38. The pound buys $1.31 and a euro 13. LBC weather feeling colder today with sunny spells for many, but scattered showers developing in the south and west, a high of 11 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
There's an old Thai saying that roughly translates as, the family who takes the internet on holiday can locate a less crowded beach. Particularly handy, my friend, if it's peak mating season for nippy little crabs. Pack the internet with an eSIM from Aerolo. That's A-I-R-A-L-O.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 5 minutes after 12. Can you think of a politician who, if the actual Attorney General, the UK's top law officer, a prominent politician, who the UK's top law officer was urging to apologise to contemporaries who claimed he had racially abused them while at school? Not just the UK's top law officer, also one of the most senior Jewish government ministers calling upon a prominent politician to acknowledge and apologise for the deep hurt that he had caused many people with his rancid, anti-Semitism. How much coverage would you expect that to get if, for example, it were Jeremy Corbyn who was being called upon by the Attorney General to apologise for allowing or in Corbyn's case, it was mostly allowing anti-Semitism, although he did indulge in it himself, he would argue accidentally, offering support, for example, to a muralist who had painted an incredibly anti-Semitic mural, which the removal of which Jeremy Corbyn objected to, under his account, without knowing what was actually in the mural, and we can't prove otherwise. But can you think of what would have happened to Jeremy Corbyn? How much coverage it would be getting, dare I even say, on LBC, let alone in various newspapers, if the UK's top law officer had urged Jeremy Corbyn to apologise to contemporaries who claim that he had racially abused them while at school, including in the case of Jewish schoolmates sidling up to them and growling, "Hitler was right," or gas them, sometimes adding a long hiss to simulate the sound of the gas showers. This is a gentleman called Peter Etedgui, who also said he'd never experienced anti-Semitism growing up, so the first time that this vicious verbal abuse came out of Farage's mouth was deeply shocking. It wasn't just Jews, however. Peter goes on, "I wasn't his only target. I'd hear him calling other students P-word or W-word. Alan Sked, of course, the founder of UKIP, reported that Farage regularly used the N-word in his company, in fact explaining why they shouldn't bother having ethnic minority candidates because they were never going to win the N vote. Again, that's the former LSE academic and founder of UKIP, Alan Sked, recalling the adult Farage, not the teenage Farage. He would urge students of colour to go home. Peter Etedgui goes on, "I tried to ignore him, but it was humiliating, it was shaming. This kind of abuse cuts through to the core of your identity." And then other classmates have queued up to endorse his recollections. One, Anthony Butler, saying, "Peter's recollections of Nigel Farage's naked racism and anti-Semitism in his school days left me with a deep sense of regret. A contemporary and classmate of Farage, I clearly recall him relentlessly hectoring and bullying Etedgui with shouts of stupid Y-word in the playground. Peter was a small, rather shy and sensitive boy, and Nigel was a physical coward who could easily have been silenced, but I do not recall anyone doing so. If he will accept it, I apologise wholeheartedly to Peter Etedgui." Another, Jean-Pierre Lihou, Farage used to say things like, you know, Judah to Peter, which is the German for Jew, in the way it was said in the 1930s, with a long U in a menacing way. Farage used to say things like, "Hitler was right," and "gas him," you know, that sort of thing. But he also used to sing this song, which I later discovered was based on George Formby's "Bless Them All." But he had a whole load of lyrics on which I can remember it verbatim. He would sing, "Gas them all, gas them all. Forgive me for this, a trigger warning for you. Into the chambers they crawl, we'll gas..." And then more language I'm not going to repeat on the radio. Ending with, "and all their effing kids." Another, Martin Russell, recalls, "Farage certainly made comments to the Jewish guy in that class, Peter Etedgui, comments like under his breath, and comments about how they had missed you, that sort of thing. Noticeably more of those times than the rest. He was known for it across the school. And on it goes, Bob Jope, a former teacher, Andy Field, Mark Haywood, Dave Edmonds, Tim France, Nick Gordon-Brown, Luke Gray, one pupil from a minority ethnic background who remains anonymous, seeks to remain anonymous. Another, similarly, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 other former pupils. "I remember him singing on occasion," says one, "leading those songs." These would be the Hitler Youth songs that David Lammy apologised for suggesting Nigel Farage had sung, because, of course, Nigel Farage, well, he sort of oscillates, as we'll hear in a moment, between denying and dismissing, and then denying and then dismissing, and then dismissing and then denying and then dismissing. "I definitely heard him singing racist marching songs at various occasions. If it comes to it, I would happily stand up in court and say it. My overriding memory is just a nasty little so-and-so and a racist." I think that line there might be crucial. "I would happily stand up in court and say it," because that, of course, will inform any decisions taken on whether or not to pursue legal action against the now in excess of 20 former classmates who have come forward with similar comments. Another, "I was in the CCF, that's the Combined Cadet Force, with him from 1979 to 1982. He did teach the younger members of the CCF the infamous Gas 'em All song, or at least led the singing of it on CCF coaches to training areas. Yet another former classmate, schoolmate, pupil. He was very strong-minded and had strong views about particular races. The word, and then the Y word used to describe Jewish people, was frequently deployed, used about 50 times in a row. I remember one particular thing he would do, a gesture where he would put his left hand over his left eye and make a sign, I can't say that out loud, although it referenced a former Israeli defense minister, while he used a very recognizable hand gesture used to denote masturbation. There you go. That's about the most sanitized way in which I can describe what this pupil remembers him doing. These are all different people, by the way. I haven't cited a memory longer than one sentence from the same person. These are all different former pupils at Dulwich College. His behaviour towards cadets of ethnic background was no better than to those of Jewish religion. He held a cadet rank of sergeant or similar, so was able to issue work or task details of his own devising. All pretty grim and pointless usually. Guess which ethnicity or religion got the wrong end of his stick? Another one. He was someone who always had slogans. He would repeat things ad nauseam. He would certainly say, the National Front is the white man's front. Whenever you watched a film in class and there was a black face, he would say, are you English? Of course, it is a member of his current political party who objects to seeing black faces in adverts, and has not been disciplined by Nigel Farage. I believe the phrase she used was that it drives her mad. Well, I guess she's in good company. Unless, of course, he's changed enormously in the interim, in which case you would have expected him to do what the Attorney General is calling upon him to do and apologise, or at least account for his behaviour. One thing you may have noticed, and I don't know how closely you're following this coverage, because guess what? It's not getting a lot of coverage. But one thing you may have noticed, if you have been following this coverage closely, is that he has not availed himself of any opportunity to condemn either anti-Semitism or racism, either while apparently dancing on the head of a pin over what he is and is not responsible for. I followed this stuff very closely over the years. I've written about some of these accounts in my last book, How They Broke Britain, but the people... And I have spoken to some of these people before, but they weren't ready to put their names to their recollections. Recollections which I will have to keep repeating. Nigel Farage often denies, but not always, but often denies. And at the current time of talking, he is largely denying what he is being accused of by now over 20 classmates. But the reason why they didn't want to put their names to it is because people don't want to draw this sort of attention down on themselves. Some of them still don't. There are more out there with similar stories to tell, I can tell you that categorically, and there are more telling their stories now, still using the coverage of anonymity, still cloaked in the anonymity that they deserve. It's people like Peter Etteguy and Jean-Pierre Lehoux who have decided, and it's a brave thing to do, because it puts you in the public eye, it puts your head above a parapet. They've never asked to have their heads put above. They've decided that obviously his riding high in the opinion polls and his enchantment of much of our right-wing media, who have shifted effortlessly from telling you Boris Johnson was a stand-up guy to telling you that Nigel Farage is a stand-up guy, has been so jarring and so arresting and so complete, which is why they have decided to come forward. So, I mean, there it is, and almost... a frankly extraordinary catalogue of accusation and recollection, which is garnering up to and including the Attorney General now calling upon him to, at the very least, apologise for the hurt that he caused these people at the time, and he has done precisely nothing. If you've been wondering where he was, now you know. He's hiding, like a coward. He's hiding because he knows that if he were to be having one of his regular press conferences, what happened to the press conferences he was having every 10 minutes? Because he knows that there's a small window now where journalists would actually find the wherewithal to ask him questions about these incidents, these allegations. Journalists would actually avail themselves of the opportunity to hold his feet to the fire on this kind of thing. He appears to have temporarily surrendered his season ticket for Laura Koonsberg's Sunday morning BBC show. If you're wondering why, the answer is he's hiding. He doesn't want to have to account for these recollections, these accusations, these comments. He's claimed that he had never directly really tried to go and hurt anybody. If you're Jewish and you're listening to this, could you perhaps explain to the rest of us how you could suggest that somebody was missed by the gas chambers, can be construed as not trying to hurt somebody or not directly insulting or hurting somebody? I don't know. But neither do I know why this is not garnering the kind of coverage that the much less obnoxious allegations of anti-Semitism that were levelled at, for example, Jeremy Corbyn garnered. Jeremy Corbyn, a party leader, who I don't think at any point was leading in the opinion polls, was he? Nigel Farage currently leading in the opinion polls. Historic examples of, in Corbyn's case, usually accommodating anti-Semites or anti-Semitism, not actually making jokes about gas chambers or singing Nazi songs. Farage would appear to be enjoying something of a free pass from the rest of the media. One journalist has stepped up to the plate. Sharon Preet Kara had a crack at him. Well, there's two examples of it, actually. The BBC's political editor in Wales managed to get 4.5 minutes with him last week. And ITV's correspondent, Sharon Preet Kara, got a few seconds in order to put these questions to him as well when they tried to have a post-budget presser. But the reason why he's not popping up left, right and centre at the minute is because he is, for once, actually frightened that journalists might do their job. But that doesn't stop reporting. That doesn't stop reporting. What? Why do you think... And I'm going to choose my words very carefully. I always do, but, you know, nobody's perfect. Given that, particularly since the hideous events of October the 7th and the subsequent offensive in Gaza, culminating, of course, in what is widely regarded to be genocide, the allegation of anti-Semitism has been made probably more in the last few years in this country than at any other point I can remember. It's a stinging and a hefty allegation. Why is Nigel Farage not receiving more scrutiny for this extraordinary number of contemporaries coming forward with truly hideous stories? I'm going to play you some of the rare examples of him popping his head above the parapet since this happened. This is a man who you can't get off the television. He's on the television and the radio more than, he was on Question Time more often than David Dimbleby a few years ago. Why is he not getting properly scrutinised over this? It's not a rhetorical question. I want to know why you think it is. I've got my own theories and thoughts. Perhaps some people who've used anti-Semitism as a rhetorical device in recent years, often to try to silence criticism of what Israel was doing in Gaza, maybe they are not as concerned about it as they've previously professed to be. Or maybe I'm missing something here. But given that you can accuse almost anybody who has called into question Benjamin Netanyahu and his far-right government's conduct in Gaza of anti-Semitism, how come the same people aren't going off after Nigel Farage with his gas chamber jokes like a rat up a drainpipe? 03456060973 is the number that you need. So we'll have a little listen to how he copes with these questions, and then we will have a look at the questions or the question of why he seems to be allowed to have this stuff on his record while other people categorically are not permitted to have rather milder examples of prejudice and bigotry on theirs.
This is LBC. Listen on the move with the new LBC app.
At Laithwaite's, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high, and low, and we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track? We certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at laithwaites.co.uk. Laithwaite's. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, stop up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with...
Think. Do the 4-trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
Looking for a fixed passive income backed by real demand? With ulezprosperity.com, you buy the car, we rent it from you for a set period. You stay the legal owner and we pay you up to £600 per month in fixed rental income. No hassle, no maintenance, no tenants. It's a straightforward asset-backed rental agreement. Visit ulezprosperity.com for conditions and to learn more. That's ulezprosperity.com. Simple, steady, secure.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 60 60 973.
22 minutes after 12 is the time. I think this is probably too serious territory to open up the doors of Idiot's Corner, but Martin answers the question of why Nigel Farage's hideous anti-Semitism, as recalled by countless classmates, is receiving such scant coverage from people who normally report on every wrinkle of his brow. Martin's response is, we simply don't care. Oh, I mean, mate, you might not care about Jewish people being told that the gas chambers, it was a shame that they didn't end up in the gas chambers, but I do. Most people listening to this program do, but I'm grateful for your input, because is it the case perhaps that Nigel Farage fans don't care? People voting for or flirting with reform are perfectly comfortable with the idea of putting a man who tells Jewish schoolboys that they belong in gas chambers into Downing Street. Maybe Martin does speak for rather more people than I would like to believe. And again, tempting though it may be to press the history button and have a look at what else Martin has to say on various subjects to see what kind of Venn diagram a character like that constructs in what passes for their conscience. The idea that that this is kind of acceptable? I don't know. What other answers can there be to the question of why this isn't garnering anything like the attention that it would garner if it was any other politician? And listen, there are arguments you can make, and which he's tried to make in a sort of characteristically worm-like fashion about, it was so long ago, it doesn't matter. I can sit here today at the age of 53 and categorically tell you I've never said anything to a Jewish person about gas chambers, and I can categorically tell you that I never will. Even when I was 5, 15, 25, 35, 45, and give me a couple of years and I'll be 55. So why is he getting away with this? And what does it say about people who normally profess, particularly in the context of criticising Israel, normally reach for, often quite rightly, the highest levels of outrage in the context of anti-Semitism, or even alleged or perceived anti-Semitism? Why have they got so little to say about this? 0345 6060 973. I truly don't know. But here is one journalist, Gareth Lewis, the BBC's political editor in Wales, doing what, frankly, every journalist in the country worth the description should be doing every time he pokes his weaselly little head out of the hole in the ground that he's currently hiding in.
Did you racially abuse fellow pupils when you were at school?
No, this is 49 years ago, by the way. 49 years ago. Have I ever tried to take it out on any individual on the basis of where they're from? No.
At school, categorically on the record, you did not racially abuse fellow pupils?
I would never, ever do it in a hurtful or insulting way.
That's not quite the same as not doing it.
It's 49 years ago. It's 49 years ago.
What difference is it? What difference is the time?
Isn't it? Well, I just entered my teens. Can I remember everything that happened at school? No, I can't. Have I ever been part of an extremist organisation or engaged in direct, unpleasant personal abuse, genuine abuse, on that basis? No.
You're not quite... That's very, very caveated. You're not quite ruling this out. The question is, did you ever racially abuse fellow pupils in school?
No,
you've caveated it with
intent.
A hurtful way.
Not with intent.
What do you mean, not with intent? I don't understand what you mean by not with intent. What does that mean?
You wouldn't do.
But what does that mean?
No.
No what?
No. I have never directly really tried to go and hurt anybody.
But you're opening the door there to perhaps you did it without meaning to offend.
Have I said things 50 years ago that you could interpret as being banter in a playground that you could interpret in the modern light of day in some sort of way? Yes. But isn't it funny?
Okay, so you did say stuff to these people then?
I've never directly racially abused anybody, no.
Again, define directly for me. What do you mean by directly?
By taking it out on an individual on the basis of who they are or what they are, no.
Again, taking it out on somebody is different to saying
stuff
to somebody.
Have I ever misspoken in my life, in my younger days when I was a child? Probably.
So, the people then who've made these allegations...
Yeah, they've got good memories, haven't they?
Well, they're telling the truth, are they?
They've got good memories, haven't they?
Are they telling the truth, Mr.
Well,
Farage?
Suddenly, after 49 years, they seem to have perfect recollection. I would say to you, there is a strong political element to this.
Okay, again, a slightly different answer to the question. Are they telling the truth?
No, they're not telling the truth. There are people who had very different... By the time I was 18, there were people there with very different political views, of course. And they disagreed with them. And, you know, right now, today... You can say one thing in politics, and another person takes it and says, that's sexist, that's racist, that's whatever it is. That's what happens, you know? All I can tell you is, by the time I was a grown-up, leaving that school, there was never quite any question of those things. But did I have disagreements with people? Mm-hmm. Political disagreements, yes.
Let me put it another way. Did you say things to these people that you did not intend to be hurtful or racist, but they took it that way?
I hope not.
So possibly you did then?
I hope I didn't. I'm going to say no, I didn't. I hope I didn't. None of us can be sure of anything we say ever, even today, that somebody else might take to be hurtful. But intentionally, no.
Would you apologise to them?
If they were genuinely hurt, of course.
Okay, so is that an apology? Are you saying sorry to those people?
No, I'm not, because I don't ever did anything that directly hurt anybody.
But yet they may have felt that.
Well, we're living in that world, aren't we? We're living in that
world.
What
do you mean, living in that world?
Well, you know, I might say...
Did they take offence at racist language?
Look, you know, people can say you can say someone's overweight and they can take serious offence, or you can choose not to say it. I have not done anything. And by the way, you are talking about something in 1977, and nobody has perfect recall of events of half a century.
Well, 20
ago.
People have recalled this, which would suggest there's a good collective memory.
Yeah, which just shows you there's a huge political element to this. It's just nonsense that 20 people could say something like that without it being political in every way.
Yeah, you're not quite ruling out not
I'm
saying
I'm not
these
ruling
things.
Out I didn't misbehave at playgroup when I was six
okay.
or five.
Well, we're talking about a lot older know. Than this.
Well,
you're not
30.
Ruling out either that you said these words.
Oh, dear. It's 50 years
I
ago.
I still don't understand the relevance of the time.
I have not directly tried to insult anybody.
Again, that caveat directly. So you're almost admitting that you've said these words and have not...
I'm not a vicar. I may have said things last week that someone might have taken offence to, all right?
Did you say things back at school that people took offence to?
Without any shadow of a doubt. And without any shadow of a doubt, I shall say things tonight on this stage that some people will take offence to and will use pejorative terms about. That is actually, in some ways, you know, what open free speech is. Sometimes you say things that people don't like. Have I directly been racist towards people? No, never.
I'm not going to repeat some of the words that have been said, but no. they were quite specific and it was very direct. Is that a true recollection, then, of what was said?
No, I don't believe it is for one moment.
Okay.
Again, worth reminding you, Dr. Alan Sked, very prominent academic at the London School of Economics, recalls Farage using the N-word very, very liberally when he first joined UKIP. Alan Sked was the leader of UKIP. And he's lying, of course, about his age, because well into his sixth form, he stands accused of making these comments. Not denying all of them, tried to initially, threatened legal action, although that ship seems to have sailed. He continues to deny making any comments about gas chambers, although similarly Peter Etedgui and many of his contemporaries categorically recall making them. I think of all the things that are disgusting about what you just heard, the idea that a Jewish person would somehow forget or misremember that kind of conversation, that kind of comment is, to my mind, curdling, actually. Who can truly claim that they're surprised by this, by these recollections, allegations, memories, call them what you will? You've really got two choices, haven't you? You're either going to pretend it doesn't matter because you're not publicly prepared to say that you're supremely comfortable with this kind of thing, both historically and currently, or find me someone who's being called the P word or the N word with genuine hatred. And who would chalk it up as banter or claim that it was easily forgotten, and I'll find you a liar. Here's another example. That was brilliant, wasn't it, by Gareth Lewis? You heard how calm he stayed and how blithely Farage expects to be able to gloss over it and move on to the next point. I've said it before and I'll say it again. He's the easiest person in politics to pin down. It's just a miracle that so few people bother to try. Many, of course, are too busy tickling his toes or quietly nodding along with his bigotries and hatreds. But some you could name, probably. You're surprised to see them not taking a rather stronger stand against what he quite plainly represents. But Gareth Lewis, they're staying super calm and just also doing that thing about asking him to define what he means by certain words. All of these comments getting filed under political. I can tell you one thing with absolute certainty, and that is that these people have been, many of these people, at least two that I have encountered personally, have been sharing these memories, these recollections for years, but they did not want to have their own names in the public eye. And now they've decided that they have little choice, that honour demands that they go public with these accusations. I can tell you that without a shadow of a doubt. Here's ITV's Charanpreet Kaur putting a question to him just before his post-budget press conference last Wednesday.
You said earlier this week that you never tried to hurt anybody with the comments that you made at school. You've described them as banter. Some of those who are on the receiving end clearly disagree. So given that they say you did hurt them, would you like to apologise to them?
Well, one person says they were hurt. If they feel they were hurt, then I'm genuinely sorry. But I never, ever, ever would have said or done anything like that directly to a human being. Absolutely not.
He continues to contend that he categorically, or rather one of the people on the receiving end of this abuse continues to contend that he categorically did say the things he is accused of saying, and there is a long queue of people who witnessed it as well as people, of course, who were on the receiving end of other forms of racist abuse. I have a very strong memory of him using the W word for what we now call people of Afro-Caribbean origin and the P word for those of South Asian origin, says Dave Edwards. Mark Hayward saying, I distinctly remember him coming in several times chanting Oswald Arnold Mosley, who of course was the leader of the British Union of Fascists. So why is this receiving so little attention? 0345 60 60 973. Here's Amelia Cox with the headlines.
An inquiry into the murder of Sarah Everard has found a quarter of police forces don't have basic policies to investigate sexual offences. The Angelini inquiry was set up after the 33-year-old was killed by a serving police officer in March 2021. 12 more prisoners have been mistakenly freed in the past month and two are still at large. Justice Secretary David Lammy says he's reassured the missing inmates are not violent or sexual offenders. Mr. Lammy is due to reveal plans to reduce the number of trials which are heard by a jury in England and Wales later. They're expected to be reserved for more serious cases as part of attempts to cut a huge backlog in the courts. LBC weather, a mix of sunny spells and scattered showers drifting in from the southwest. These will mainly affect western and southern areas, drier with bright spells in the east, a high of 11 degrees.
This is LBC.
At Lathwaite's, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide, searching high, and we mean really high, and low, and we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track? We certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at lathwaites.co.uk. Lathwaite's. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
With Lloyd's Home Insurance, there's £50,000 to be won. When you cover the glassware no one's actually allowed to use, or the garden shed, a.k.a. your fortress of calm. Rated excellent on Trustpilot, you can be confident with your cover when you take out a new home insurance policy and be in for a chance to win £50,000. Get a quote with Lloyd's today. Buy a new home insurance policy direct from us by the 31st of December 2025. Offer T's and C's apply. Policy terms, limits and exclusions apply.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad! Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use.
Interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down, not off,
said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with three tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
Our Black Friday event is now on. So book a Jet 2 holiday now and save £200 per couple. As always, you'll get 22 kilograms of baggage included too. Whether you want a last-minute escape or to get next year's holiday sorted, book with just a £60 deposit per person and secure your Black Friday saving now. Jet 2 holidays. Package holidays you can trust. After natural protected. Subject to availability and conditions.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
12:36 is the time. Sophie, bear with me. Phone lines are open. Why on earth is this politician, Nigel Farage, getting a relatively easy ride over allegations from a growing band of schoolmates, already in excess of 20, who recall him engaging in hideous racism and, frankly, close to unbelievable anti-Semitism? Once again, he continues to deny some of it, although it's hard to pin down precisely which bits he admits and which bits he doesn't. This is what he told LBC on Wednesday. I can tell you categorically that I did not say the things that have been published in The Guardian, aged 13, nearly 50 years ago. A lot of what was published in The Guardian focuses upon his time in the cadet force when he was 16, 17, 18. And the other bit that, of course, is worthy of mention in just that first sentence of his statement is that he was claiming not long ago that nobody could possibly remember what had gone on so long ago. So he can categorically recall exactly what happened then. He can accuse the people who claim that they were victims of his hideous anti-Semitism and racism of either lying or misremembering, but also, this is Farage in a nutshell, it's important this. Will that work? What can get me off the hook for this? Well, no one can possibly remember what happened then. Oh, rats, that hasn't worked. Clearly these people are going to insist that they do remember. So I need a different line. I need a different wriggle. I need a different potential lie. Oh, yes, I can remember absolutely everything that happened. So it is possible to recall with perfect accuracy things that happened decades ago, but only if you're me. So he can suddenly accept that people are perfectly capable of remembering categorically what happened 50 years ago or 45. So there's, even in the first sentence of that statement, not only have you got pure Farage deception and distraction and dishonesty, but you've also got epic hypocrisy that is visible from 100 miles away. Let's move on to the second sentence. Isn't it interesting? I am probably the most scrutinised figure in British politics, having been in public life for 32 years. Several books and thousands of stories have been written about me, but it is only now that my party is leading in the polls that these allegations come out. That's a lie. A lot of these allegations have been previously made anonymously. Michael Crick, of course, unearthed the letter written by a teacher at Dulwich College when he was in the sixth form, so several years after being 13, in which she questioned the wisdom of making a self-confessed fascist a prefect. Her name, even I can remember her name, which is extraordinary given that these allegations, according to Nigel Farage, these allegations are only coming out now. Her name was Chloe Deakin. She was adamant that he had been overheard singing Hitler Youth songs while on CCF camps in the surrounding countryside, and that this would preclude him from being a prefect. So when he claims that these allegations are only coming out now, he is lying. He's also further insulting one of his accusers, because Peter Etedgui has made it clear that the reason why he has now decided to put his name to his recollections and allegations is precisely because Farage is leading in the polls. So where previously he wanted to remain anonymous, now he is going public in the hope of increasing the volume on what he is saying. Because it didn't really occur to anybody until relatively recently that this country would be bent backward or bigoted enough to put a man like this in Downing Street. The polls suggest that we might, so these people now feel compelled to come forward. Again, Farage knows that. Farage understands that. He is pretending not to, and betting, as always, on not being properly held to account for it by journalists. So when he says, it's only now that my party is leading in the polls that these allegations come out, he is lying. And then he adds, I will leave the public to draw their own conclusions about why that might be. Of course, the public don't have to. They can ask the classmates why they are only now coming forward and putting their names to their memories. And the simple reason is precisely because they fear for the country if somebody like this were to end up in Downing Street. So that is also a lie. Disingenuous, dishonest, deceitful, whatever D word you prefer. I think we can all agree on disgusting. We know that The Guardian wants to smear anybody who talks about the immigration issue. None of the things he's accused of really have anything to do with immigration. So why is he bringing that into things? Answer, to appeal to the people that carry him shoulder high through the metaphorical corridors of British public life because they think he is as racist as they are. Let's get immigration on the table as quickly as possible. So it's nothing to do with immigration. There's no suggestion from any of these classmates of his that they weren't born here. What's he talking about? Answer, distraction, deception, dishonesty. Another sentence. The truth is, I have done more in my career to defeat extremism and far-right politics than anybody else in the UK from my time fighting the BNP right up to today. A statement so hideously ridiculous that it barely merits scrutiny. But if you want to find out about his relationships with far-right extremists, there are several books I could recommend, including my own, which actually picks up on some of the accusations that he claims have only recently come out, despite the fact that it was published 2 or 3 years ago. I think some of it's in my first book as well, which was published 5 or 6 years ago. This is not the first time the desperate establishment has come after me, and it will not be the last. So a former school friend, 20-odd former school friends are the establishment now. If you go to Dulwich College, does that automatically make you part of the establishment? Or is it only the people that abhor anti-Semitism and racism that end up being part of the establishment, whereas the people who apparently indulge in it, they're the victims of witch hunts and unfair persecutions? What on earth does this have to do with the establishment? Shall I read you the list of names again? And you tell me what qualifies him to call them members of the establishment. So, again, I can categorically say that the stories being told about me from 50 years ago, that's a lie, are not true. But you said no one could possibly remember what had happened 50 years ago, so how can you possibly suddenly remember what did or did not definitely happen? Funny, isn't it? How easy it is, once you tug on a single thread, to watch the whole carefully cultivated facade fall to pieces and unravel. So why do people fail, refuse, decline to tug that thread so often, so repeatedly, and so completely? Why do you think he is getting such an easy ride? Plenty of you pointing out to me, and make of this comparison what you will, that he was absolutely adamant that at the age, I think, of 15, Shamima Begum could be held completely and categorically responsible for everything she thought and did for the rest of her natural life. So, again, why would different rules apply to him? Why would the actions of one 15-year-old be dismissible? A 15-year-old who, of course, had been groomed by profoundly unpleasant influences, but another 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old, 18-year-old, engaging in objectively hideous and disgusting behaviour, somehow deserves the benefit of the doubt because it was banter, or because nobody can remember. Oh, except me. I can remember it all, he claims, simultaneously, or because you can't hold me to account for things that I said then, but I'm certainly not going to condemn anti-Semitism or racism now. Wouldn't it be embarrassing if there was a long and fairly comprehensive list of him engaging in conspiracy theories widely regarded as anti-Semitic long after he became an unpleasant carbuncle on public life in this country? That would be slightly inconvenient, and again something that I wonder why nobody else bothers to dig into. You can find out after this.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
We are very wedded to the principle and practice of being tried by a jury of fellow citizens. Should that change? And a report into women's safety says we are very much not safe.
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or our new LBC app.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
This Friday's Euro Millions jackpot will have you dancing like nobody's watching. Yeah, baby. Just make sure nobody is watching. Get in this Friday's Euro Millions draw. Play on app.
Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
While all the Whos of Whoville were at McDonald's eating, the Grinch from his lair started plotting and scheming. Gherkin-flavoured fries and odd socks will send them crackers. So try the Grinch's new meal and head down to Macca's. Until 4th of Jan from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary while stocks last. Grinched for adults.
Kev, it's Black Friday madness. Customers, calls, emails.
Then you need something built for busy, like iPhone 17.
And right now, you can save £144 on a 36-month plan in EE's Black Friday sale. iPhone 17, a delight at work, even when your coffee's gone cold.
Nice one, Kev. Have a fresh hot coffee on me.
Search EE Business today. BT and EE, better for business.
Excludes 20% VAT. Ends 4th December. Terms apply.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad! Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use,
interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down, not off, said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with 3 tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
A southern train is a place where you can wind down and catch up. A chance to let conversations flow and plans unfold. And swap doomscrolling for telling stories. Too good for the group chat. Make the journey part of the joy and save 1/3 with off-peak group tickets at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
Leading Britain's conversation. LBC with James O'Brien.
It is 12:47. Let me show you how it works for the core audience. Here you go. This is from Gareth. Isn't it coincidence that as all the main parties now feel threatened by reform and they are a genuine threat, suddenly people's memories clear and the media is able to find lots of Nigel's ex-school friends who claim he was mean to them and said racist things, never remembered them during his UKIP days, EU Parliament days or during the Brexit campaign? Strange. Gareth, to be fair, mate, you sent that at 12:34. I've subsequently explained how all of those things are blatant lies that you've been fed by Nigel Farage. I'd be interested to know whether it's changed your perspective at all. But again, let's run through them one by one. These claims were all made during in previous years, just that people weren't ready to surrender their own anonymity. A teacher at his school questioned whether or not somebody who was reported to have sung Hitler Youth songs as he marched through the Kent countryside would be suitable material to be a prefect. You mentioned UKIP. Why were they never remembered during his UKIP days? Asked Gareth. Mate, the actual founder of UKIP was one of the first people to publicly state on the record that he had repeatedly heard Farage use racist language in his company, explaining that they shouldn't worry about fielding ethnic minority candidates because they were never going to win the N-word vote. So listen, you can call Alan Scott a liar if you want. I'm sure Farage has done, will do, or has flirted with the idea, but you can't claim that none of these allegations have been made previously, Gareth, any more than you can pretend that a teacher didn't write a letter to the headmaster about his alleged Nazi sing-songs, or indeed that the founder of the actual UKIP recalled him using hideously racist language on a regular basis. So now that you know this has been going on forever, Gareth, do you change your view? Or do you just change your excuse? I don't know. What about adult Farage? George Soros, of course, has often been the receptacle of all manner of anti-Semitic conspiracies. Tucker Carlson, formerly a presenter on Fox News, has subsequently started flirting with the worst extremities of far-right rhetoric, some would say consummating the relationship. Here is Farage on Tucker Carlson's show back in 2018.
He wants to break down the fundamental values of our society. And in the case of Europe, he doesn't want Europe to be based on Christianity. Now, all of this, whether it's Soros or some of those very strange people in California, all of it is based on some kind of self-loathing, some sort of guilt trip about the past. And in Soros's case, it's a guilt trip, of course, about America's, Germany's wartime actions, the way the Jews were treated. In America, in many cases, it's how the native Indians were treated. It's all based on guilt, but it's not based on reality.
This idea of Jewish people being dedicated to the idea of undermining Christianity or Western values is an anti-Semitic trope as old as the hills. Tried to defend himself on this radio station later that year.
We've got open society with its many billions to spend every year, and I'm arguing we need to have a proper debate about the role of George Soros, not just in this country or America, but right across the European Union and the Western world. I think the Russian thing is nonsense, but I do think
we should be discussing the role of Soros. Now, when I did this back in November, as I said earlier, I was called anti-Semitic for doing it. I thought, why on earth is this wave of trolls on Twitter and Facebook attacking me? I've never been called this before. Just for the record, folks, when George Soros was born 87 years ago in Hungary, and he was of Jewish birth, that is true. But when he's asked in an interview, Mr. Soros, are you religious? No. Do you believe in God? No. He may have been born Jewish, but actually, I would say he's an atheist. All right? And I think the reason some on the Remain side and the left are throwing this tag of anti-Semitism is they're scared what's going to be uncovered over the next 2 weeks.
What has been uncovered, I wonder? Fascinating there. The SS famously ceased their pursuit of Jewish people in Nazi Germany if Jewish people professed to be atheists, or if Jewish-born people insisted that they weren't religious at all. That would earn you a free pass from the Holocaust. Stuff that comes out of his mouth. And remember, he said they'd never been called anti-Semitic before, which must come as news to the people queuing up to claim that they remember him making jokes about gas chambers when he was at Dulwich College. Oh, and you remember Alex Jones? Of course you do. He's the bloke that accused the grieving parents of murdered children of being a hoax, something that never prevented Farage from appearing repeatedly on his programme. In fact, he used to have a season ticket for InfoWars and appeared there in 2018, again repumping this globalist rhetoric, which is widely regarded as a synonym or as a camouflage for anti-Semitic tropes.
I think, you know, the globalists have wanted to have some form of conflict with Russia as an argument for us all to surrender our national sovereignty and give it up to a higher global level. They've wanted it for years, and now they see their opportunity.
That's the globalists, or the Jews, are trying to take over the world trope for you in glorious technicolor. Here he is on a web show hosted by a far-right, avowedly anti-Semitic American pastor called Rick Wiles on True News Radio. This is where he used to have to peddle his stuff before the collective wisdom of the UK media decided to turn him into something of a celebrity.
The violence become very high indeed.
But is this going to become the norm? For nations that are in debt, I mean, are we going to see someday the central bankers of the world install the Prime Minister of Great Britain? They're going to install a future President of the United States? Is this where we're going?
Well, you know, if I'd been on this show with you a year ago, and I'd said that when I come back in a year and we talk, there'll be a puppet Prime Minister in Greece, and even in a country of the scale of Italy, nobody listening would have believed it. But it's happened. It's happened with barely a murmur and barely a protest. So I would say that a very, very bad and very dangerous precedent has been set, and frankly, anything now is possible.
Bankers taking over the world as well. I'll leave you to wonder what the historical precedents are for that kind of rhetoric, or indeed that kind of opinion. And finally, back to Soros in the EU Parliament. Again, you have to remember the historical context of people claiming that Jews secretly run the world, or if they don't already, they certainly want to.
It was Mr. Moscovici said at the start of this, the leak of all these papers and lists of people with offshore holdings has come about because of the Society of Investigative Journalists. But what's not been said this morning, and I think is relevant, is that the funding of these investigations came from one George Soros. Now, I say this at a time, I'm going to come back to so what, and it may have some personal interest for you as well. I say this at a time when the use of money and the influence it may have had on the Brexit result or the Trump election has reached a level of virtual hysteria. Just last week, the Electoral Commission in the UK launched an investigation to find out whether the Leave campaign took offshore money or Russian money. This came about as a result of questions asked in the House of Commons by one Ben Bradshaw, somebody linked to an organisation called Open Society. I just wonder, when we're talking about offshore money, when we're talking about political subversion, when we're talking about collusion, I wonder whether we're looking in the wrong place. And I say that because George Soros recently gave Open Society, his organisation, which of course campaigns for free movement of peoples and supports supranational structures like the European Union, he recently gave it $18 billion. And his influence here and in Brussels is truly extraordinary. Open Society boast that they had 42 meetings last year with the European Commission. They've even published a book of reliable friends in the European Parliament. And there are 226 names on that list, including yours, sir. I thought you'd find this interesting. We even had last week Mr. Verhofstadt lobbying on behalf of Mr. Soros at the Conference of Presidents in a battle that is going on with Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary. If we're going to have a debate, and we're going to talk about full political and financial transparency, well, let's do it. So I should be writing today to all 226 of you, asking some pretty fair questions. Have you ever received funds, directly or indirectly, from Open Society? How many of their events have you attended? Could you please give us a list of the meetings of all the representatives, including George Soros yourself? And I think this Parliament should now set up a special committee to look into all of this. And I say that because I fear we could be looking at the biggest level of international political collusion in history.
I think at least three people clap there, to be fair, in a room full of people. It slightly changes the complexion of that, doesn't it, now that he's refusing to conduct any inquiry whatsoever into Russian bribes being accepted by his own colleagues, close friends, party leaders in Wales. He apparently doesn't have the wherewithal of the funds to do that, although 10 minutes ago he was promising to conduct a nationwide inquiry into grooming gangs. And remember that the widespread attempts to somehow portray George Soros as trying to take over the world was in many ways a classic example of an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. So there it is. My apologies to everybody who was waiting to contribute to this hour of conversation. I was intending to let you answer the question of why he is allowed to get away with this in so many ways, including by people who normally reach immediately for the anti-Semitism allegation when dealing with, for example, people who dare to criticize the carnage that continues to unfold in Gaza. But hey-ho, I'm sure that they'll find their platforms, their loud hailers, their mouthpieces, their consciences tomorrow. Because that's it from me for today. You can listen back on our free global player to anything that you missed, or indeed on the LBC app. Stay up to date with all the top stories, all the opinions, the news categories that you have in the order you want. Pause, rewind live radio, listen to a range of podcasts, including mine. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Tom Swarbrick will be with you at 4 on LBC, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, James. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, has just announced that jury trials will be scrapped where a likely sentence would be less than 3 years. Is that the right decision? We're going to start the programme with that at 2. To talk about very young children and social media, 800,000 under fives, so kids between the age of about 3 and 5, are using social media. Almost half of all under 13s, including some as young as this, fives, have a social media profile. Wakey, wakey, parents. I mean, for goodness sake. The Angiolini report into violence against women and girls makes very depressing reading indeed. We'll look at why from 3. That's all coming up over the next 3 hours here on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, an inquiry into the murder of Sarah Everard has found sexual offences are not afforded the same response as other high priority crimes. It was set up after the 33-year-old was killed by a serving Met police officer in March 2021. LBC's Fraser Knight has more details.
It says there's a lack of momentum and ambition when it comes to stopping violence against women, as it warned efforts to halve the crimes are being powered by goodwill rather than with proper money. The report highlights some positive work that's been done since Sarah Everard was killed, but it says it's not joined up enough and said women will continue to be harmed.
The Home Office has promised to halve violence against women and girls within a decade. A report into the Hillsborough disaster has found 12 police officers would have faced gross misconduct action for fundamental failures on the day. The watchdog has spent 13 years looking into actions before, during and after the tragedy in 1989. The Justice Secretary says he will scrap jury trials in England and Wales for crimes that carry a likely sentence of 3 years or less. It's part of plans to tackle a backlog in cases in the courts following a report by Sir Brian Leveson. Serious offences, including murder, robbery and rape, will still go before a jury. David Lammy has been speaking in the Commons this afternoon.
Sir Brian also proposes restricting defendants' right to elect for jury trials, a practice not found widely in other common law jurisdictions. And let's be honest, it's a peculiar way to run a public service. Our world-leading judges should hear the most serious cases, and I agree that they and the magistrates should decide where a case is heard. This will prevent defendants from gaming the system.
President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is due to meet Vladimir Putin in Moscow. It's the latest step in diplomatic activity aimed at brokering a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia. A new forecast suggests UK inflation is set to remain among the highest in the G7. The OECD says it will top the list of advanced economies this year and remain second highest at 2.5% next year. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 21 points at 97.24. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.13. LBC weather, a mix of sunny spells and scattered showers drifting in from the southwest. These will mainly affect western and southern areas. Drier with bright spells in the east, a high of 11 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Driving can often be a bit ordinary. The commute, the weekly shop. But with SEAT, it's never an ordinary drive. Because right now you can get an extra £500 off the SEAT Ibiza and Arona on top of existing offers. Just order by the 15th of December and take delivery by the 31st of December. Search SEAT offers to find out more.
T's and C's and exclusion supply. UK retail customers 18 plus. New stock vehicles only. Subject to availability. Saving including VAT applied to on the road price.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. If you're just joining us here at LBC, throughout the afternoon, we're not going to exclusively look at matters of justice, but there is a sort of heavy bent towards matters of justice on the programme today. We're going to begin with a discussion about that announcement just a few minutes ago in the House of Commons from David Lammy, the Justice Secretary, about jury trials. We'll hear much more detail from Chris Chambers, our Northwest of England correspondent, about the Hillsborough report that by the IOPC that has just come out. A lot of it to be expected, but it never ceases to shock and amaze me when we read again and again the level of injustice, actually, at the heart of that story, and the fakery and the lies and the failures of the state and the police in this case in particular. So we'll talk about that too. We'll also talk about the Angiolini report from Three. This is a report, second part of a report into what police forces are doing to tackle violence. Well, not on their own, of course, but they have to be at the centre of it, to tackle violence against women and girls. It makes really grim reading. Again, kind of to be expected, given that any woman will tell you and any man who loves women will tell you, and girls, that women are not safe in this country. And the Angiolini report finds that very much to be the case. I'll save more detail on that till a bit later. But justice, as I said, is going to run through this programme today. This is David Lammy just a few minutes ago outlining his jury service reforms to tackle that backlog of trials in the Commons. This is just moments ago.
I will follow Sir Brian's bold blueprint for change. First, I will create new swift courts within the Crown Court with a judge alone deciding verdicts in tribal either way cases with a likely sentence of 3 years or less, as Sir Brian recommends. Sir Brian estimates that they will deliver justice at least 20% faster than jury trials. And whilst jury deliberations remain confidential, judges provide reasoning for their verdicts in open court. So this will hardwire transparency into our new approach. Sir Brian also proposes restricting defendants' right to elect for jury trials, a practice not found widely in other common law jurisdictions. And let's be honest, it's a peculiar way to run a public service. Our world-leading judges should hear the most serious cases, and I agree that they and the magistracy should decide where a case is heard. This will prevent defendants from gaming the system, choosing whichever court they think gives the best chance of success, and drawing out the process, hoping victims give up.
The Sir Brian that he's alluding to there is Sir Brian Leveson, a retired senior judge, perhaps best known for his work, perhaps best known by most of us for his work on media, but very much involved in advising the government on this. We also heard that the Justice Secretary had asked Sir Brian Leveson to write a second report focused on efficiency, has asked, and modernising the justice system using technology. Here is the Shadow Justice Secretary, Robert Jenrick, responding to these reforms.
2020, he said, criminal trials without juries are a bad idea. You don't fix the backlog with trials that are widely perceived as unfair.
Remember that, David.
In 2017, in his report into prejudice in the criminal justice system, he found juries, and I quote, act as a filter for prejudice. But now he's become Justice Secretary, he's scrapping the very institution he once lauded. Yeah. Which is it? Will the real David Lammy please stand up?
I'm sorry. I'm minded to say, Mr. Jenrick, it's Parliament, not the old Vic. I mean, come on. Perfectly valid points to make, but talk about ham. Anyway, Penelope Yibbs joins me, Director of Transform Justice and a former magistrate as well. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Is this the right direction of travel, and has it gone far enough, too far? How do you see it?
It's not a great direction of travel. Clearly, we have a real problem with cases taking too long and victims and defendants also waiting too long. But this solution, it actually has got a fundamental difference from Sir Brian Leveson's idea. And even if you thought that Sir Brian Leveson's idea was good, he said that if you take away jury trials for these in-between offences, you should have a judge flanked by two magistrates. So that's three people deciding on these quite long prison sentences and whether people should get them. And remember that prison can destroy people's lives, families, prospects, etc. So we're talking about really important decisions. There are not European countries who have one judge making those kind of decisions. Sir Brian proposed three, and the government's changed that to one.